that there's a reason why I need to be alone. You show me there's a silent place that I can call my own. Is it mine? Oh Lord, is it mine? You know I get so weary from the battle. Many times it seems that you're the only hope inside. Is it mine? Oh Lord, is it mine? When everything's dark and nothing seems right,
John.
Yeah, let me try this one. This is working?
Okay. Yep, that's much better.
Okay. All right. Let me restart here. Anyway, welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is October 10, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you are listening in over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a conference, our call-in number is 605-562-3140. And our participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. You can click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side. Okay, we're going to start off tonight with tonight's scriptures reading is going to be Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doeth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin, and ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye were without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards, and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh, which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits, and live? For they truly, for a few days, chasteneth us after their own pleasure. But he, for our profits, that we might be partners or partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterwards it yieldeth the peaceable fruits of the righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Okay, that was Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. See, a couple of things tonight. I'm going to read something very short. This is probably going to start going out tomorrow. We were sending messages out to the sheriffs, some daily messages or weekly or something. We were sending some messages out through email and fax. And I think some of those were a little too complex for them. We covered too much information. So what we want to do is sort of give them a tweet. And I think it's going to be almost like a daily tweet. It's going to be a little bit of a long daily tweet because it's going to be one page, but it'll be 14 font and spread out pretty well. So, it's not really all that much either. But sheriffs need to really come to understand their power and their authority. We, the people, don't have much of a chance if we don't have the sheriffs working with us. We're going to lose this whole game. And this is the purpose for having the committees of safety and working very closely to get these committees of safety going in every county and getting people to communicate and start getting a relationship with their sheriff and getting him educated into the things he should know and doesn't know. All too often, and we're all guilty of this, if something comes up we don't understand or we don't know, we kind of get caught in the situation like a deer in the headlights and we don't really understand, and then the next thing moves forward and then we just move forward with the next thing and we never consider what it is that we didn't understand. And so therefore we live in ignorance. And when it comes to law, when it comes to relationship with God, comes to the relationships that we should have with our elected officials, we are ignorant to those things. They are to work for us. We're not to work for them. These people walk around. They've got the whole thing backwards, and they think they're prestigious, and they got power and authority. We need to make them feel more like the servants that they are. We need to make them so that they walk humble, because if they don't walk humble, they will walk proudly. And if they walk proudly, then we have a problem. So we're going to have to beat them down to some degree. But we first all starts with knowledge. We have to start feeding knowledge, and with knowledge and understanding comes responsibility. We're going to have to feed them that responsibility, that honor, constantly putting before them the fact that they have a duty, they have an honor, and they have a job to do. They have a purpose, and their purpose is to serve the people, not the judges, not the courts, although they are to serve the business of the courts. But remember, as long as the courts are doing the will of the people, they're serving the people. But if they're serving a court that is under the will of tyrant justices and judges, then they're serving the tyrant. They're serving the servant who has taken control of the house, who has become the master. We have to take it back, and to take it back, we have to educate. You know, we do get occasionally some answers from sheriffs when we were communicating with them. Some wanted more information. Most of them remained silent, didn't say anything one way or another. And then you get the real wacko sheriffs. I mean, these people are really out of control. You can tell they're criminal-minded. There's no doubt about it from some of the things they say or do, you know, to us, we the people. Obviously, they never even read the paper. But, you know, people sort of shy away from long-winded things. So I think we've got to keep it short, you know. It's sort of like weaning them off the breast with some milk and at some point eventually giving them the strong meat so that they can chew upon it and really digest the true power and authority that they should be exercising as they work for we the people to protect the unalienable rights of we the people. So here's the first message going out. I thought about what that might be, and I want to give it something that they all seem to have a problem with. And it's not something that really, well, actually, it does help us. They need to get some power and some strength, a little bit of a muscle. And I think this first one gives them a little bit of a muscle. There's a concern with sheriffs. It's sort of underlying. It sort of comes out in when you listen to them or talk to them. They're concerned on what they can do and what they can't do. And what's going to happen to them if they try to do something and the powers that be say, no, you can't do that. What are they going to arrest them? Are they going to remove them from office? What are they going to do? Here in New York, there was threatens of removing sheriffs from office. Thankfully, a lot of the sheriffs in New York, I think, understand that they can't, that the governor can't do that. The governor made that threat, by the way. And the governor can't do that. The governor has no power to remove any elected official. No elected official has any power to remove another elected official. And this is what all the sheriffs, first and foremost, I think, need to understand. So we're going to give them a really good, powerful bone for them to chew on that will really kind of empower them, make them feel a little more bolden to do whatever it is that they think they got to do, and hopefully we're going to feed to them the things that they need to be doing, little by little, spoon-feeding, one piece at a time. And so here's the first one. Again, hopefully this is going to start going out tomorrow. That's my plan. We'll see once what happens. If it didn't go out tomorrow, it'll go the next day. But I'm sure it'll go out tomorrow. I'll start faxing it. I'm going to discuss with the other leadership on whether we should send this message to every elected official in America. We've got all of their faxes, so we can do that. Although some of them don't work, some of them have cut them off and so on, but we got a lot of them, you know. So maybe we're missing 10%, 15%, I don't know. I'll have to ask Gary. I think Gary has his finger on the pulse on that one and how much of a loss we have. But we also have emails. So what we lose on faxes, we'll pick up on emails. And I believe between the emails and the faxes, we're hitting every single sheriff in America. We did send out the hard copy paper concerning martial law, which I want to talk a little bit about after I read this paper. So let's read this paper first. Only the people, this is the heading, it's large 36 font size font. Only the people can remove the sheriff from office. This is important for them to understand. An elected official cannot be removed from office by another elected official. Not even the governor can remove an elected official within their state. The National Conference of State Legislatures, NCSL, confirms that the only way to remove a sheriff from office is by voter's recall, impeachment, or indictment. And then we give the source, the location of where we got this source, the website of NCSL. And we go on. Impeachment is regarded as power to be used only in extreme cases and is relatively rare. For example, for more than 200 years, the U.S. House has impeached only 18 federal officials. And then we give the source. According to the Office of Legislative Research, OLR, in the past 200 years, only four sheriffs were considered for impeachment. Let me repeat that. In 200 years, only four sheriffs were ever considered for impeachment. But no sheriff, none of those four, was successfully impeached. In 1980, Vermont Sheriff Leroy Null was indicted and removed from office for perjury, destroying official records, and urging someone to commit perjury. And we give the source of where we got this from. These are government sites that we get this information from. So it's very interesting, and there is one case, recent case, which I'm going to bring up in a minute. It's very interesting that they tried to impeach sheriffs four times and failed four times. But it is very interesting that one indictment was brought on a sheriff, and that went through, and he's out of office. And that's the power of the people. On July 27th, this is a recent case, on July 27, 2016, the Alabama Supreme Court impeached Summit County Sheriff Tyrone Clark for willful neglect of duty and corruption and running drug rings in the county jail. We give the source of that information. Sheriffs are elected by the people and can be removed from office by the people through recall or indictment. The sheriff can be impeached by the state Supreme Court if there is actual proof of criminal activity. Sheriffs are elected by the people. Okay, that's what I just read, I'm sorry. When sheriffs protect the unalienable rights of we the people from our out-of-control federal agencies like the BLM that intimidates we the people on behalf of corrupt politicians for land grabbing, they are not committing a crime, but honoring their oath of office and saving America. And then it ends up with just a statement on the bottom, the county sheriff, America's last line of defense. And then we give the website, powerofthecountysheriff.com. Now, this has not been posted up yet. I'll post it up tomorrow. And we're going to be looking to be sending out a daily or maybe every other day message. You know, we'll try to do something daily, something short, a couple paragraphs, give them some power. One of the things I think I'd like to do next is to make them understand that whenever any kind of an agency, like a federal agency, comes into their county, they're responsible for that federal agency's action. So they need to be contacted by that federal agency. They need to make it clear that that federal agency better not even think of coming into my county without first calling me. And then once the person's coming into the county, that sheriff needs to be with them to make sure that all the paperwork is correct, that they do indeed have a real, true, signed, verified warrant. Because if they don't have one, the sheriff needs to stop them from going forward. And let me tell you something about the feds. They never have a correct signed wet ink signature from a judge warrant. Let me repeat that. They never have it. Ever. Maybe in an extreme case they may do something, but it is rare. Certainly anything the IRS does, if the feds come in and enforce, they never have a warrant that is real. There's nothing. So the sheriff needs to be kicking these people out, saying, don't come in here without the constitutional warrant. Stay out. So I think that's going to be the next thing we're going to talk about to them, which we'll try to write up tomorrow, maybe get out the next day. We'll be posting these things up on powerofthecountysheriff.com. Let me repeat that. powerofthecountysheriff.com. We'll post them up there. Now, that is a page that goes to our website, National Liberty Alliance, and you can find that under the Sheriff tab. I think we have a Sheriff's tab up there. Let me see. Yeah, we do. Power of the Sheriff. Okay. Let's move on. So we have to really bring the sheriff up to par. He needs to understand his position. And, you know, we've been talking about this for a couple of months, that on May 28th, 2016, the Federal Reserve defaulted on its debt. That was the day the debt was due. They defaulted. Nothing happened on that date other than the fact that they defaulted. Now, what's the repercussion? They got together and they made some discussions and they put a date out there, and that date was September 30th, I believe. Some people were saying 27th and the 29th. I heard the 30th from a couple of sources, so I've been running with the 30th. I'll stick with that. But the 30th was the deadline. But we've been saying for the last couple of months coming up to this point in time, we don't know what that means. We don't understand exactly what's going to come about. This is all uncharted waters. And I decided to take the position and think that something that we have done recently, just the week that it was happening, that week the papers were going out, And we were warning every elected official in America, and believe me, every single elected official in America has received this message. Now, there might be a handful that haven't, but look at, they got the peers up there when they get together and they talk. Hey, did you get this message? Come on, don't tell me they didn't. You know, we got some really silly, stupid, ignorant, I don't know what you want to call them, people that are judges, you know, or a clerk. You know, what does this mean? I don't understand it. What do you mean? Just read the paper. Anybody can understand, read the paper. We're telling you and warning you that there is subversion against the United States of America from enemies foreign and domestic within our government to destroy this nation. And they are hell-bent on bringing a martial law into this nation. There is no way that anybody can take this nation over without having martial law applied. Let me repeat that. Without martial law, there is no takeover of America. Cannot happen. Never will happen. Never will happen. So what do we have to do? We have to prevent martial law from taking place. So we have announced this to, we sent hard copies with each individual senator, every single congressman, the Department of Justice. We sent it to every single marshal, every single FBI special agent in charge. We sent it to every single federal judge, okay, all with their personal names on it. Their name was named right on the top where the heading goes, where court cases open, and we actually opened a court case here in New York up in Albany, and we filed it looking for the number. We were still in battle for that, and if we have to pay the stupid $400 to get the number, we will pay that $400, and then we're going to argue that $400 back. We want our money back. But first, we're going to pressure this, pressure on them this week to push out this number so that we can start filing other papers into this court. So we have a lot of plans on what we're going to do with this court case. But in any event, all of these people, even the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all of them, got a copy with their personal name, comma, ETAL, which means many other people behind them, a lot of others. We listed all of those people, and we gave them the location of where that list was. But ultimately, we just basically said on the paper that this paper was going to all legislators on the federal level, both houses, every legislator in every single house across America. It was going into, every single house in every state, both houses across America. They were going out by fax, though. All the federal individuals got hard copy with their personal names. The rest of them got copies through faxes and even emails. A lot of them were duplicated. And even those who we sent hard copies out on, they also got through email and or fax. They can't say they didn't get it. And they've been forewarned that we, the people, have decided and we're resolute in the fact that we're not going to put up with their martial law. And we laid that whole paper out. Now, we did read that paper a couple of weeks ago, so I'm not going to get into that paper at the moment. But that is up on the website. You click on Grand Jury, and I believe it's one of the top papers. You'll see it there. I believe that that paper played an important role at this point in time, that they did not collapse the economy yet. They are going to collapse the economy. Now, I may be wrong in that, and I may be right in that, and I don't think we'll ever really know. But, you know, I know Alex Jones, who I don't like to listen to often because he's too depressing. And, you know, he seems to be right often, but he also is a little exaggerating sometimes, I think. But nevertheless, he has made some points. And every time he finds that a black flag operation is going to happen, he starts to hit it hard and get it out and get the information out. And they seem to throw it off. They stop it. So maybe we've done that too. I don't know. But no matter what we did put the fear of the people into the hearts of all these elected individuals. There's no doubt about that because we told them at the end of the day, when we the people win and we accomplish our goal and take this nation back and find ourselves back with our right footing, we're going to look you up. And anybody who has complied with these people for martial law, anybody who just sat on the sidelines and did not do anything to allow the martial law potentially coming through, any of those people are as guilty as the principal and will be tried as the principal and found guilty, maybe, maybe not, by the people. We're going to have a jury, so I don't know that the jury's each individual needs to be judged independently. But if they're found guilty, they will pay the ultimate price, whatever that is. Again, that is up to the people, not us, not me, not you. That's up to the jury that hears the case, whomever those people may be. But they will hear those cases, and these people will pay the ultimate price according to the law. And I think that that is an important thing that we had done to put the fear of the people into these people. And we can't let loose no more. We can't be, you know, not continue. That's why I'm seriously thinking of not only letting the sheriff know what their power and authority is, but I think we need to let the feds know what the power and the authority of the sheriff is. Definitely we want to get this to the FBI agents. We want to get these to the marshals, and we want to get it to the federal judges. That's a no-brainer. I think everybody on the federal level needs to get this paper to understand that only the people can remove the sheriff from office. So, Mr. President, don't think about it. Mr. Governor, don't think about it. Mr. Congressman or whoever you are, don't think about it. You can't do anything when a sheriff stands up for we the people. And I'm telling you, this governor here in New York State threatened the sheriffs of removal from office who would not obey the command coming down from him concerning the fact, because he was trying to take guns away from the people. And they even made the move, and I don't know where they're at with this. I haven't heard anything about it, but I heard that they were moving quite some time ago all of the control all of the permits for carrying weapons from the sheriff to the state police. That's something we have to do something about. But there's so many other things going on. We have to keep our eyes focused on the prize. And the focus of the prize is to save America. If we can save America and take back control of our judiciary and take back control of our political process, everything else will become fixed on its own almost overnight. You know, within 6 months, maybe, America would be where she should be. Economically speaking, it could be longer. But again, it's up to the people how much we can prepare for the disaster that is heading to America. The day is going to come because they have to do it. They've gone too far. There's no place for them to hide. And they know we're going to be relentless to find them out. And if we get to them before they do whatever they do, then we're going to get to them and they're going to be tried in a court of law and justice will prevail. But if they do collapse the economy, and I think they're going to feel at some point, no matter what, they got to take that chance. They're going to pull the plug. And I'll tell you a little bit of what it's going to look like. What's going to happen is you're going to go to your ATM machine to try to get some money out, and it's going to be out of order. And everywhere you go, it's going to be out of order. And you'll call the bank and you'll get a recording. And whatever they'll say in a recording, I don't know. Some say there'll be a bank holiday that day first, and then they'll come back up online. And then you'll find out that you can only take out $50 a day or $20 a day or whatever it is that they decide. So the first order of business is destroying, because it's all electronics. They do not. That'll cause a rush on the bank. Everybody will be pushing the bank to get $20, to get the $50 every single day. The banks are not going to be able to hold that up. There's not enough cash just to give them to on the short end. Maybe for a while there will be, but on the short end, they're not going to be able to do it. Will checks be honored and things like that be honored? I don't think so. There's going to be a real, real tight hold on the bank. I think that's what's going to happen. Anybody that's got cash, you know, I don't leave any cash in the bank. Even money that belongs to NLA, you know, I don't leave it long-term in the bank. I'll put it someplace else and then put it back in the bank when I need to make the payments. But we don't too often get excess cash that we would take it out. But it's happened a few times where we did collect some monies doing some things, and I took the cash out and put it someplace else and then put it back into the bank as we paid our bills. But I suggest people leave bare minimum in the bank, only whatever is going to cover your checks plus $20 and put the rest under your mattress or something. I don't know, whatever you want to do with it, but wouldn't leave it in the bank. Because the people who have cash in those days are going to get a little bit of an extra time of being able to hold themselves up. So that's the next step. But at some point, the dollar is going to completely fail and collapse. And when that happens, that's where the Committee of Safety comes in. Even gold and silver is not going to help you that much. It'll help you, no doubt about it, but not that much. okay? Because people are not going to be working. Things are going to get bad. Trucks won't be moving. Trucking won't be moving. Electric will be a problem, so on and so forth. You know, you could just imagine the snowball effect. There's no money. No one's getting paid. Everybody's going to be doing what? Making sure they have shelter, looking for food, looking for water, looking for safety. Many people leaving the cities. And it's going to be havoc all over this nation. Unless we, the people, do something about it now. And that's why we've been pushing really hard to build the committees of safety. We've been given more time. Nothing happened. We hoped that nothing would happen, and it didn't, so nothing happened. It doesn't mean something's not going to happen. It damn well is going to happen. Think not it's not going to happen, because it will happen. That's an absolute fact. The only question is when. My wife was watching Fox News Sunday, I think it was. It was a Sunday morning Fox News program, and they were in discussion. And just nonchalantly, she said, recorded that, but somehow it got deleted, and I was looking for it. I don't know if anybody else can find that. We should look for that. But nonchalantly, it was mentioned, okay, that there was going to be a very serious economic collapse in America in 2017. But then they continued in discussion, and nobody else in the discussion picked it up. It just went over everybody's head, and they just kept going. So that is telling us something. That's their little Freudian slips. That's their way of getting messages out. They always tell you what's going to happen before it happens anyway. They always do. I noticed down on those little string lines that run across the TV, and my wife has noticed that numerous times. I remember when the nickels, when they took the nickel out of the nickel, and I was looking into nickels because I found out that they were going to take the nickels out of nickel. And so I started collecting nickels, hoarding nickels, buying $100 box worth of nickels every week, and putting them aside because they had nickel in it. And my wife was watching, it was Fox News again, or maybe it was CNN, I don't know. She was watching the news, and she was reading the ticket thing down on the bottom, and there it was, the nickel to be removed out of the circulation, so on and so forth. And that was it. That's all they said. Nobody spoke about it. There was no debate, no discussion. But it was right down there on the bottom of the screen. They told us. They told us what was going to happen. I think we got to be a little more conscious of those little tickets down on the thing, because I think that's going to tell us what's happening. And especially something as bold as a slip of a economic collapse in 2017 and then goes undiscussed. That's a pretty big one. Now, again, I didn't personally hear this, so if anybody else has heard this, maybe they can be more specific on what was said. And if anybody can find that, my wife was pretty sure it was Fox News Sunday, but it was a Sunday morning program with the discussion going on, so it probably was Fox News Sunday. If anybody could find that, maybe they can get that to us. I'd like to actually hear the exact words that were being said. All right, anyway, so look, there's going to be a major problem coming up. There's no getting away from it. The question is when. I hope we have 6 months. I hope we have a lot more time, because we're not ready yet. We just aren't ready. We're not doing the job we really need to be doing. People are not taking it serious enough. And now with this last concern that came through and then nothing happened, and I tried to make the point, we don't know what's going to happen, and it could be that it could be 3 to 6 months before anything starts to take effect. These people can do anything because they control the entire economy. They can even go to the banks that decided that they're going to go the other route and go a different direction and gone to them and say, look, you're going to hold the dollar up a little longer because let me remind you about something else. And they'll put the fear of them into them, you know. Evil threatens. They intimidate. And that's what they'll do. And they'll make sure things will stay going for a while. And I think that's what's going on. The question is, how much time do we have? Do we have 3 months? Do we have 6 months? Can we get into next summer? And what are we going to do with our time between now and then? Are we going to get out there and build committees of safety, build a relationship with our sheriff, educate our sheriff, prepare for the coming collapse that is no doubt coming to America? And I want to tell you something. This is absolute surety. If we can establish committees of safety in 3/4 and better of our counties, if we can establish committees of safety in most of our counties in America, don't have to get them in every single one of them, just most of them. If we can do that, we will succeed on numerous things. We will prevent America from being taken over. We will maintain and secure the Constitution for the United States of America. We will get through this economic collapse quickly, very quickly. I believe we could do it in 6 months. But that's only if the people are working together to solve this problem and not sitting in some concentration camp waiting for the end of the guillotine line. Because that's where we're heading for if we don't do something. It's coming. What are you going to do? That's the question. We need to do it. Okay. So, we need to continue to plan committees of safety. We also need to continue building grand jury administrations. We haven't spoken about that much lately, but I think we have to speak a little more about that more often. Let's get back into talking about the administrations as much as we have to be talking about the committees of safety. The committees of safety are extremely important because that's the power and the authority of the people. That is really, that's the body politic. That is the true body politic. If you understand body politic, the essence of body politic is the committee of safety. The essence of body politic ultimately is committee man. That's who it is. And the committee of safety is the committee man. That's where the committee man came from, out of the committee of safety. When our founding fathers put together everything they put together, they didn't just go disappear and go home and lock their doors and forget about everything. No, they continued to control things through the committee man process. That means nobody got onto a political ticket without the consent of the people. And that's government by consent. You know, all these criminals would never get in. If they didn't know the Constitution, we'll require them to take courses. We'll require them to take our courses. And if they don't know the Constitution, they haven't taken the course, we're not going to put their name on the ballot. Sure, some of them will be able to feed themselves in other ways. But once they break the law somewhere, we're going to indict them. And we'll take them out from the other end. From the grand jury's position. You see, because you control your government by controlling your political, your body politic, controlling that, the people, we the people controlling it, and we the people controlling the administrations for the grand and also the trial jury. That's, we have to control that. We have to make sure that they are not hijacked like they are now. Puppet juries doing the will of the judiciary, who is doing the will of the elite. Certainly is not the will of the people. So we have to take that back, the judicial powers. We have to take the political powers. And then we, the people, control our destiny. We, the people, then truly will have government by the consent of we, the people. That's how it's done. And that's the essence of what National Liberty Alliance is bringing. But people need to get educated. And without education, if the people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. Thomas Jefferson said, I believe it. Okay, real quick, ICANN. ICANN was turned over to the foreign sources or something. I'm not sure exactly how that works on that end of it. I haven't been able to really look too much into it, but I did look a little bit into it. You know, President Obama, he made the decision to relinquish the federal control over ICANN. Now, the federal had control over ICANN, and now they've given it to the United Nations, okay? And China is playing a big role, I understand, in this. And they, of course, are going to try to stop free speech. So that's a problem. Now, one of the things I found was very, very interesting, though, because they said that once ICANN is controlled by foreign entities, by the United Nations, that they'd be out of our reach. That's not necessarily true. I am really confused on this issue. I really am. Nevertheless, because Obama wanted to do it, I think we should have kept it. Okay. But nevertheless, at this point in time, at least for a little while, the immediate time, it's still a California-based nonprofit corporation. That has not changed. Unless they find a way to move that into another corporation, that's a problem. If they, as long as it's a California-based operation, we can do something about whatever it is that they think they're going to try to do on the internet. Because once we take the courts back, it's a no-brainer to deal with that problem. But nevertheless, that power and authority was ours. We discovered it. We initiated it. We built it up. We made it international. We made it what it was. Why would we want to give the power and the authority of that up? And we, of course, as long as we have the Constitution, and free speech will remain there, and that's the key to this whole thing. So we do need to get that back, just like we need to get back our post offices. We also need to get back our electric companies, because they're all foreign-owned. The core, they have stripped out everything out of America. They destroyed our manufacturing base. They destroyed a lot of our food base. They've destroyed farming. And now they're destroying mining and logging and cattling, all of that out west. So totally being destroyed as we sit at home and do nothing. We need to get up and do something. Now, we're going to be making some big moves out west in the next week or so, I hope. And I'm not going to say how and what we're going to do, but we'll unfold it as it goes. We're going to be making huge, huge moves in a lot of different court cases across the United States in the next couple of weeks also. Within the next week, I'd like to say do it this week, but I don't know if it's possible to get it done by Friday to be able to put the call out and get a meeting going. So it may be next week. But I'll be working on it with others tomorrow. And if we can hammer it all out tomorrow, we'll be calling a special meeting. Tomorrow's Tuesday. We'll call it for Thursday. We'll put off the Thursday night meeting that we normally have, and we'll take that time slot for this purpose, to put the call out to all those who are sitting on the grand jury, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, in order to come together to make some important decisions on which way we're going to go and what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And so hopefully that'll be this Thursday. If we can't get it completed tomorrow, which is Tuesday, and we get it done by Wednesday, I think Thursday is too early. I think we need at least 2-day notice to get that out. So we'll move it out till next week, maybe next Tuesday. Friday is not a good day to do it because it's a weekend. Saturday and Sunday, obviously, is not a good day to do it either. Monday is this. I thought about doing it on Monday, but I don't think we should. I think we need to stay focused on what we do on Mondays here and do this on another night. So it's going to be either Thursday or Tuesday. You're going to get an email. We're going to send out numerous messages letting people know that the grand jury is meeting right here in this room. Again, it'll be 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time will be the meeting time. It'll be 6 o'clock on the West Coast. And we got a lot to discuss, and it's going to be, I think it's going to open some eyes, and it's going to reveal a little bit about what our plan is. Not the whole plan, but a little bit of what our plan is. That'll be executed within the next couple of weeks. We are on the offensive. We are not on the defensive. NLA, or Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, has never been on the defense. We have always been on the offense. But we have learned that they can't answer us. We learned in the very beginning they tried to answer us very quickly, even tried to threaten us with all kinds of things and sending agents out and everything. And they stopped. They just stopped. Because they couldn't bear the truth. FBI agent comes to my house. I didn't say that. That Thomas Jefferson said, "Oh, did you read the whole thing? Where's the other paper? Let me give you the whole paper here." Yeah. I didn't say that. Judge Scalia said that. I'm just telling you what he said. That's all I'm writing down. And they left kind of shaking their heads. They said, "No, this case is closed. We have no investigation going on. We don't find nothing here." You know? So those were just the regular Joes that came to my house. And they've seen me 3 times. Different people, different places. And in each case, it was the same way. We've also heard from others who have been visited, especially in the beginning. And that stopped. That's not happening no more. Now I know there is intimidation going on by the marshals. It's time to put the weight onto the marshals. The marshals need to be knocked down a few notches. They need to understand that they don't rule we the people. And they don't have authority over any of us in any county. And they need to go through the sheriff to deal with us. They don't have that authority over that. And that's where these papers are going to be so important. The marshals, the FBI, and the sheriffs absolutely will get them. But I think we're going to make sure at least all the judiciary. We might extend that to the political realms. It just depends. We only got 8 fax machines running. So I got to talk with Gary. This is 1 page going out, not 3, 4, 5, or 6. we might be able to do the whole gambit in a 24-hour period. If we could do it in a 48-hour period, then maybe we will send it to everyone and just send out a message every 2 days. Maybe that's the plan. We're going to see what we'll do. We'll figure that out. We'll let you know next week what our plan is on that. Okay, so grand jury meeting coming up, important things to discuss, important things, decisions to be made, and it'll give a good picture, an idea. This meeting will not be recorded, so you don't think you're going to, if you miss the meeting, you're going to get it. You're not going to get it. Grand jury does not record the meetings. We can't control if enemies come in, but we'll recognize who they are once they open their mouths. It just becomes obvious. But that's okay. The evil will do evil no matter what you do. And good can only do good and do it openly. And that gives evil more of a chance to do more evil. But there's something about good over evil. Light always defeats darkness. It may take time, but it'll happen. See what else. Okay, so this California-based nonprofit corporation that manages the databases are still in California. We can reach them. Okay, two other things I want to remind you. We've mentioned it a little earlier on. We need money. We always need money. We pretty much are caught on the bills, but we do have more mailing we need to do. And if we don't get our number this week, we need to get $400 up so that we can pay for the number, the federal number up there in Albany. And then one of the first things we will do, we will go after them like they'd never been gone after before concerning this $400. We want our money back. We're not paying them for justice. This is our courts. Justice is free to all men. A lot of changes need to be made concerning that information, flow of information from the courts. They hide it all from us, every bit of it. And whatever we can get, we got to pay through the nose, you know? Okay, and the last thing I want to do is remind everyone what we're talking about, and that is time is short. There is no more time. Damn it, if we're blessed with 6 months to prepare, let's use that 6 months and let's prepare. Let's get these committees of safeties off the ground in every county. Let's get together with our sheriffs. Let's save America for ourselves and our posterity. Let's do it, and we need to do it now. Today, tonight, when this call is over, it needs to be done. Let's do it. We need people in every state really pushing on this, saying, I'm going to work with get three, four, five people and work through your state to establish committees of safety in every county. If I had the time to do it, I don't have the time to do it. I want to tell you, I'm trying to do it. I'm going to try to do it anyway, but, I got ill. I think I was just exhausted is what I think my problem was. I had to take a rest. But in any event, let me tell you, we got to go through New York. We have so many people in New York. We've got lots of connections in New York. We know everybody in New York. We know all of the Liberty Group leaders everywhere. We need to go through New York. We can go through New York and get New York done in 3 months. I know we can. If I could put all of my efforts into doing that, I would have New York done in 3 months. I would do that. I can do that. I will do that. We did it pretty darn quick when we didn't know anybody. Maybe 6 months before we really had the state going. Okay, but we traveled everywhere. We met people, and people, came to trust us. We're not there to take over their group, but we want to empower you. We want to give you information on how to become empowered. We want to give you an education. That's what we're about. We're not about controlling anyone. If we become about controlling anyone, then we just became them. So time is short. Jan, are there any questions?
Yes, I have several questions tonight.
Okay.
The first two are combined. They relate to the message that you sent out on May 28th on the Federal Reserve officially defaulting on the national debt of $19.5 trillion.
Correct.
Two questions. Who or what was the source of information, and wasn't Congress the debtor of the loan?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know exactly how it works out with Congress, but I remember way back when they used to speak about this on the news. they used to talk about this date coming up, and you know, we got to have the money. You know, all the Congress, they were going back in the early 2000s, they were talking about this. Okay, that there was a deadline on the debt, and there's a time and point in time, and if we don't do something, it's going to default because the Federal Reserve is not going to be able to pay it. Now, I didn't remember what that date was, but when I heard about this, Gerard, are you here? What was that woman's name that we heard this from the first time? We heard this from a couple of sources. They were verbal information. And I've been searching the internet for some stuff, and doesn't seem to be much of anything out there. But we heard it from a couple of really good sources. Also, the same thing, the same sources gave us the information on the fact that 4 months after that default, the decision was made that they were going to reject the dollar. And that was to be September 30th. But think not that these people who are the in control of this, I'm talking about the elite, can't control that. They can control that. They can extend that out. They can make it happen. They can say, you're going to continue to take in the dollar for at least 3 more months. We need 3 months. You're going to do it. Look, they went in there and they told Congress. And, you know, months later, Congress came out and talked about this. Even Ron Paul spoke about this once, that Congress was actually threatened that if they didn't vote to save one of these the big companies that were too big to fail. If they did not save those, if they did not come out of there and say, we're going to save these companies too big to fail, there will be martial law in America tomorrow, we promise you. And that's what Congress had to say. And they were also told that they can't discuss any of this. Now, many months later, this came, well, maybe a year or so later, some of this stuff started to leak out, what was going on. And this isn't the first time that Congress was threatened. There was another secret meeting that was had some years back, and we have a recording of some of this stuff where Congress was going into the secret meeting and the objections and the arguments about the secret meeting. And I forget, one congressman, I can't think of his name offhand, who rejected and did not want to go to did not go into the meeting. I'm not going into the meeting. No, but this should be open. And but in any event, this is what they do. They'll get them, they'll threaten them, and they'll then obey the master, their master. After all, the elite is the master of our Congress. You and I are not their master. The elite is the master. We should be the master, and only if we, the people, step up and take it back are we going to become the master again. But that's where we're at. So I can't give any specifics. Maybe Gerard can give more specifics. Is he here tonight?
I didn't see him.
Okay, well, maybe when Gerard comes in, or maybe I'll kind of cue him in, maybe next week he'll talk about it a little more, get more details. I get a lot of that information mostly from Gerard, but I also have spoken with and heard from some of these people that have good that are good sources. They're reliable. And if you notice, there are good economists out there that kind of pointing towards these dates too and talk about it, but they don't really talk about what's really going on, just that things are going to happen. And a lot of them were talking about, they were pointing on September 27th or 29th. We were pointing at September 30th, but it's all pretty much within the same week there. All right, what else we got?
Next question. It's about the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA. Since this is the most ungodly and repugnant law to threaten American people, why has NLA not addressed this? If you have, I've never heard of it.
Okay, do you have any details on this? Refresh my memory.
Well, that's passed yearly. It's the one that says that if they look at you and you look like a terrorist, they can incarcerate you indefinitely as long as they like.
One of the provisions
in there.
Okay, yeah, look, that's in the workings. That's part of the plan of our next meeting of what we're doing, okay? And people are really interested in knowing what's going on and participating in the yay and nay vote on this thing as a grand jury. You need to be at the grand jury meeting, which will be either this Thursday or next Tuesday, depending on how fast we can get the paperwork done. If we can get it done tomorrow, then we can put it on the record. Even if we come very close to getting it done tomorrow, and we know, well, okay, fine, we're going to be ready with it on Wednesday, so then we'll put the word out on Tuesday that the meeting will be on Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here in this room. And some of this is going to be addressed and it is going to be a major part of our plan. So we're there with you already. You know, there's a lot of things going on, and there's only so many hours in a day and so many man hours working up here, and you can only get so much done. Some things get lost along the wayside. Some things you just can't get to. And you try to grab onto it, but a lot of it falls out. You just can't get it. So we've got to stay focused on the important things. This definitely is an important thing, but it was not anything that we've been really in a position to be able to deal with yet. Now we are. So, again, we're going to talk on that on Thursday somewhat. And more information will open up as we go, as the weeks unfold. Anything else?
We do have a different type of request here. This is for they want to know if there's any video of small arms fire from American civilians during the 1941 Pearl Harbor attack. If anyone knows of any, please just contact me, jan@nationallibertyalliance.org, and I'll pass it on to the people that are interested.
All right. I think Brent brought something like that up last week or the week before, because I've listened to the tapes. And maybe if he did, maybe he can comment on that. Anything else?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, so that's it for callers. Okay, for the questions, I mean. All right, let's see where we're going to go from here. I guess we're going to move over to Brent. Brent Winters is the author of Excellence in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com, and he's with us tonight, and he's going to talk with us for a while and answer some questions. Brent, you got the mic.
If my mic is on, I assume it is.
It is. Yes, we can hear you.
Good. Oh, thank you. Well, to begin talking about committeemen, just a little experience, because John was mentioning the committeemen. Our present-day committeemen are the descendants of the committees of safety at the beginning of our country. And I was never involved in politics or government. As a matter of fact, I came from a family that my father wouldn't even let us go to the county fair because he's afraid we'd bring hog cholera home on our boots. And we didn't get out and socialize with folk. We didn't politic. Well, I decided when I was in my late 30s I was going to run for U.S. Congress, but I didn't know what I was doing. And I discovered real quickly that there were a group of folk out there that operated locally in townships, and they called themselves committeemen. And then I also discovered that those were the folks that carried the petitions I wanted to get on the ballot. I didn't know. I had to start figuring these things out, and they carried petitions, and they got me on the ballot. And then I found out that some of them took their positions real serious, and if they liked you, they would do all that they could. It was a matter of pride to some of them to make sure that their precinct of which they were a committeeman, made sure that the small number of votes that were there, as few as they may be, that I would get the majority. And it only took a little bit of their effort to pull that off, because they'd take it upon themselves to go around. Most people, you have to go after them. They're not going to come looking for you, and they're not going to try to find out who you are. You have to make the effort somehow, or someone must make it on your behalf. So the committeemen still are an important and influential position in our country. Now, there were 27 counties in this district where I ran, and if a county was solidly one way or the other, party-wise, Democrat or Republican, and we had some counties in that district out of 27 that were hardcore, viciously Democrat. It was in a coal mining region, and there are a lot of coal miners, so the Democratic Party held sway in those counties. And then other counties were hardcore Republican. Essentially, those counties were simply one-party counties. Well, where there was a one-party county like that, where the other party, for example, the Republican Party in a Democrat county, or a Democrat party in a Republican county, where it was a one-party county, inevitably that one party that was powerful would split into two parts. And there were two counties I knew of out of that district that had two separate committeemen. There were the ones that the state officially represented, and then there was the folk that formed their own committeemen in each precinct and tried to do all they could to overcome the officially recognized committeemen, officially recognized by the state government or the county government, and the juror entities that were in power. So you don't have to be officially recognized to have influence and power. And I would throw out the idea that I know that nobody's to this point with the committees of safety, but I did see this happen where unofficially people organized their own party and precinct by precinct had their own committeemen and were able to control quite a bit, and hamper anything that they thought was wrong. Well, I bring that up just in passing because it's an important part of our culture, and I do believe that these fellows at National Liberty Alliance have the right idea to resurrect, as it were, the idea of committeemen. Next, somebody mentioned the small arms fire on the island of Oahu. Oahu, that's the island where lies Pearl Harbor, where the Japanese Imperial forces attacked. And the testimony that I discovered about that didn't come from any Americans. It came from a Japanese flyer. I'd read his testimony of the situation as he saw it. And you can go look that up. You type it into the internet, type in some keywords about the attack on Pearl Harbor, and you'll discover some of those things. Well, we're talking about the militia of the several states, and trying to go through the four militia clauses to revitalize the idea that there are militia clauses, to remind ourselves that the militia isn't something that people join. It's something that is because the people of the United States or the militia, whether they understand it or not, whether Congress or the state government or the presidents or the governors recognize it or not, it's a fundamental reality. And whether or not a person then observes his duties as a member of the militia is his responsibility. And what are his duties? They're twofold: jury duty, primarily, and armed defense. And as Granville Sharp tells us, at our common law, always in the history of our common law, the history of the English-speaking people, and that's who we are, that's our culture, and always in our history, our common law has required able-bodied men to not only, I'm quoting, to not only be armed, but to be expert at arms. And that translates into this. It translates into every man obtaining at his own expense a military-grade weapon, and second, obtaining at his own effort and expense, if need be, proper safety and marksmanship skills. That's what it means. That's our law, and it is important that we do it that way, and that we don't depend upon the powers that be to provide weapons, to provide training. To do so would defeat the common law idea, I should say, the common law ideal of the militia of the several states as our four militia clauses set them forth. Now, our four militia clauses, like everything in our Constitution, the four militia clauses are not meant to explain anything, but only to set the law as it was understood and with the words of our four militia clauses. Those words freight a whole lot of common law, just as does the word jury. It freights a whole lot. Constitution doesn't explain any of it. Freedom of speech, it freights a whole lot of history into it of our common law, and our Constitution doesn't explain any of it. We could go on and on. Why the Constitution doesn't explain it is because our Constitution is clearly written on one piece of paper. A big piece of paper, true, but one piece, just like Magna Carta. Magna Carta was confined to one piece of paper. In fact, the word Magna Carta means big paper, but only one, and within those four corners of that document lie the principles of our common law applied in that day as they were needed to be applied in our Constitution. But the United States is no different. It sets forth our common law government in brief, compact draft, in compact draft, to quote our Supreme Court. American limited government under our Constitution is rooted in the Anglo-Saxons' Volkreich. Volk is Germanic speech for people. Volk, like folk. We get our word folk from Volk. Folk means people, and Reich, we spell it R-I-G-H-T, they spelled it R-I-H-T, but it's the same word, and it means duty. The people's duty. What is the people's duty? Well, flatly put, the people's duty is government. What is that government? It is jury duty, most fundamentally, and armed defense. Jury duty and armed defense, the two fundamental duties of the militia of the several states. Now, in Old England, and we need to talk about this just a little bit, I think it's important to inform oneself, the common law foundations of our militia, for there is no way to put it in place if a person doesn't understand its foundations. Our Constitution did not invent. It did not invent the things that it bespeaks at all. It mentions them and seeks to establish them clearly as though King and Parliament in England had somehow forgot them. Well, remember, King and Parliament in England didn't forget them as to people living in England. But he wasn't, King George wasn't king in England, or wasn't king in America. He called himself Emperor of the colonies and king in England. And the common law rights, that is, the duties, that's what right means in old Anglo speech, the duties of Americans, he was trying to stop them from doing those duties. Well, those are the duties, those fundamental duties. We had mentioned last week that a fundamental duty is a duty that God delegates direct to the person, direct to the individual, no intermediary, direct. And if God delegates, watch me real close on this and ponder it if you have time, those things that God directs direct, delegates direct to the individual, freedom of speech, right to self-defense, freedom of silence, freedom to discern when to speak and not to speak, freedom of association, which includes freedom of disassociation. All of those are direct responsibilities to the individual. And what God delegates directly, and here it is not re-delegatable. What God directly delegates to the individual is not re-delegatable. For instance, God gives children to men and women. Along with that, he delegates certain responsibilities. And our Supreme Court, for instance, has recognized those responsibilities. Two cases are salient. Pierce versus, I think it's Oregon, and Meyer versus Nebraska. In both of those cases, the Supreme Court of the United States confirmed that the duty, the right, which is a duty of parents to direct the education of their children, is theirs. Period. And parents, the Supreme Court recognized, have that responsibility. And that responsibility, because it comes direct from God with the child, it's not re-delegatable. You can send your child, for instance, to a Christian school to other teachers. You can allow your child to go to a government school. You can hire a private tutor to educate your child. I have friends at home whose the grandparents take the children every day and educate them while they work. But in all of those cases, every one of them, none of those parents, homeschool, Christian school, tutors, family, in none of those cases, even though they've given the responsibility over for education, the task, I should say, the responsibility is still theirs, and they will answer to God for whether or not they fulfilled that duty to rightfully educate their children, train them up in the way they should go. Well, the same thing is true of the right to speak, the right to freedom of religion, to worship God, to associate, to disassociate, to remain silent, to petition the government, to self-protection, Second Amendment. All of those are duties, and you can't delegate, for instance, self-protection and protection of your family and protection of your community. You may be able to say that, well, somebody else has got that task. The policeman around my house in my town, they have that task. The sheriff deputy has that task. The bureaucrats in the FBI have that task. Or the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines have that task. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to get out of their way and not even try to help. If that's your attitude, just keep in mind, you may think you're delegating or giving a task over to somebody else, but God doesn't look at it that way. And the Second Amendment isn't put in our Constitution. The people that screamed it down there did so in recognition that self-protection of oneself, family, and neighborhood, and state, and country is a fundamental right. Our Bill of Rights lists not all fundamental rights, but some that they wanted to make sure that government knew were protected. Then they added, of course, at the end of our Bill of Rights, that other fundamental rights not mentioned here are not to be disparaged, but are to be protected also, as need arises. I'm paraphrasing, but that's really what it means. So the Second Amendment falls in that category. No man can redelegate the duty of protection. He must do what he can. Whatever it is, he must do what he can to further the safety of himself and those of whom he is responsible. Likewise, constitutional custom empowers the President of the United States to mobilize the armed forces for war. He has concurrent jurisdiction, our Constitution holds. He has concurrent, that means at the same time, jurisdiction with the governor of each of the states over the militia of the several states or any part of them. And because an enemy attack demands an armed answer, an enemy attack demands an armed answer, quick and sharp. In the old days of common law England, before the Norman invasion, over 1,000 years ago, the Witan, that means the white-haired men, the elders, today we call them senators, empowered the king, that's the man that held that executive power, to muster the Fyrd, F-Y-R-D, that was their word for militia, of able-bodied men. He had the power to muster them for war without the Witan's consent in case of emergency, and the President of the United States and the governor of each of the states has the same power without seeking, if he has not time, he can't seek the consent of Congress. The governor cannot seek the consent of the state legislature. He must act, of course, as soon as he can. He is to inform the legislature. He is to call for their convening, and he is to inform them so that they have full oversight and understanding of what should be done. And if they wish to declare war, then whether it be the legislature of a state or the Congress of the United States to declare war. You say, well, Brent, can the legislatures of the states declare war? And the answer is yes, they can. Our Constitution provides some military restrictions to state governments. But never forget, states are sovereign. States are sovereign. They are the sovereigns of our country. The federal government exists at their permission. Clearly, the people of the United States have spoken through the states to establish the Constitution. And that in turn established the federal government, the general government, sitting in Washington, D.C. And the states, the people through the states that ratified our Constitution, provided that in certain instances, and our Constitution lays it out very clearly, for the four reasons why the president, why he can lawfully call for mustering of the militia of the several states or any part of them as he thinks needs be. But invasion is one of those states. Yes, states. If a state is invaded, I said, when the Mexican, whoever they were, the powerful people down there, drug lords or in collusion with the Mexican government, I never understood. I don't think anybody knows. But they were firing into the United States with their weapons, shooting at people. Arizona. Arizona then had right and duty. I was surprised nobody talked about it. To muster whatever military might they had and go after them. That's called war. To stop invasion of their state. The federal government also had authority under our Constitution to muster the militia and convene there. Maybe the president could have mustered the militia of Arizona, or the governor could have mustered the militia of Arizona, or the president could have mustered the militia of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, and California, or the militia of any one of the states he wanted to muster and bring down there, to the exclusion of others. That would have been his prerogative if the governor of whatever state he mustered the militia from had not already mustered the militia and taken control. And once the governor of a state musters the militia of his state or any part of the militia of his state, the president of the United States has no authority to muster that part of the militia. That's the doctrine of our Constitution. Of the United States four militia clauses as it was understood when the document was ratified and as it was understood in the days before the war between the North and the South in the days in the 1830s and 40s. And we read the writings of chiefly Justice Joseph Story, but there were others that said the same thing about it. Offensive action, of course, must be quick. Back to the President of the United States a little bit. He must receive from Congress a declaration of war before proceeding any further than Congress allows him to proceed. Once that happens, if in case of an emergency, he strikes out at an enemy using the militia, an invasion, for instance, or an insurrection that doesn't admit time, then that's what he should do, then seek the advice of Congress. Same thing with state government. I am from a part of the world. I've talked about the coal mines. There were 15,000 coal miners put out of work when I was running for office by the Clean Air Act. 15,000. And they didn't know where to go or what to do. It was as though that's very bad for the economy of the area, to say the least. But during that time, before that time, because the coal mines were there and because the mining unions began there under a fellow named Lewis, the violence was really ripe in that part of the world, and many people died and were killed. And the sheriffs in those areas had come under the control of organized crime. Two gangs were fighting, the Shelton Gang out of Williamson County and the Burger Gang. He was a mobster kind of a fellow from East St. Louis. And the violence became such a high pitch that the counties down there, the people signed petitions to the government that he would send the militia down and quell the killing. And in those days, the governor of the state, that was back the 20s, 30s, 40s, the governor of the state wouldn't do it. They repeatedly asked him to do it, and he wouldn't do it. And things got so bad in that part of the world that the Burger Gang obtained a half-track that they'd gotten from Army surplus from World War I, I suppose. I don't know where they had it. And they had an airplane or two, and they dropped aerial bombs on the enemy, or their enemy, I should say. And that's how out of hand things got. Well, that is tantamount insurrection. And most of the people that lived during that time are gone now, but back when I was running for office, a lot of them were alive, and they'd tell me stories about what had gone on there, and Charlie Berger eventually was caught and hung at Franklin in Franklin County, a public hanging, the last public hanging, I believe, in the state. But because the militia wasn't used, a lot of unnecessary killing went on. At one point, they surrounded the entire courthouse. The Burger Gang surrounded the courthouse in Williamson County and shot every window out of the courthouse and demanded that the sheriff release all the men they wanted to release. And he did. Well, that's what happens when the militia of the several states is ignored. The sheriffs in those places were cowed. The militia of the several states is something that we the people means the militia, must be ready at all times, must be armed at all times. It must be a reality to us, and it must be, I hasten that also, it must be a reality to the sheriffs. The sheriffs, some of those sheriffs in those days, appealed to the governor to organize the militia. Well, the militia wasn't, the state legislature at that time hadn't done their job to pass legislation to allow for the organization they wanted of how it was to be, how the militia was to be mustered, paid, etc. And so the sheriffs didn't feel the confidence to do what needed to be done. And so the organized gangsters controlled entirely. And wherever, this, the other lesson from that that's important is this, again, wherever there's a vacuum, in this case a vacuum of government and power, wherever there is a vacuum, organized crime will fill it. And I say also, as I've said before on these calls, wherever there is a vacuum of law, if the right law doesn't fill that vacuum, false law of false gods and all law emanates from lawgivers, anciently called gods. Whoever they may be, could be men, could be a combination of men, could be thugs of various sorts, but law is always somebody's will, whether it be the god of creation or some mere punkish man, some punkish man wound up and bound up in his own whims and difficulties, like Muhammad, like Hitler, like the Emperor of Japan, like the creatures that now hold the levers of power in many places in America. If you knew them, if we all could see them up close and know them better, I've seen a few of them up close over the years, you'd say to yourself, I don't want to get near him. I'm afraid I'd get some disease, and I certainly don't want my daughters, my sons, my wife near him, or my grandchildren, him or her. These are the people that have gotten hold of the levers of power. So it is incumbent upon us to be ready. To be ready, R-E-A-D-Y. That means ready is the idea of regular, of our militia clause, the fourth militia clause, a well-regulated militia. That means ever ready. Well, going back to, I'll just do a little more here. I've got a little time. Going back to history and our common law, the declaration of war was given from the Witten. Those were the men with the white beards and the white hair. And only then, upon that advice and consent, and by the way, over 1,000 years ago, yes, those words were part of our common law, and they are now part of our Constitution of the United States, upon the advice and consent of the Witten, did the Anglo-Dane kings levy what they call the Dane Gold property tax for raising an army. Dane Gold. That was the property tax they would levy for raising the army so they could pay the militia of the several states as they did their duty and fought. Likewise, American presidents set before Congress their proposals for taxation to support military activities. Then Congress, holding the power of advice and consent and the power of the purse, that means they're supposed to control the money, they either deny, consent, or modify the request of the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, at Congress's pleasure. Now, the power of the purse doesn't exist as a practical matter anymore. Congress does not control the money, and the reason Congress does not control the money is because Congress has abdicated its responsibility over money. It controls nothing. It allows money to be printed or entered on computers without its consent or knowledge. Therefore, if some sitting president wants to spend money, all he does is order more money printed, and he pays more people. He pays people. Is it a wonder? People ought to be wondering. The federal government has no shortage of money. Where it wants to spend money, it spends it. The reason is because it's printing it without the advice, consent, permission of the Congress of the United States. Now, that is hard to remedy. But the militia of the several states is a place to start, because an armed populace keeps government wary. That's a good word. Wary about their activities. We saw last night an assertion on the part of Donald Trump of what he would do in the way of force and enforcing the law as president. That was a warning. Now, whether or not it's true, whether or not politically he'll be able to pull it off, we don't know anything. But it is that wariness, that knowledge of the lives of those who sit in positions of power, our knowledge of that is what scares them. And then add to that that they know deep down in their heart of hearts that the American people are armed. Yes, they're scared because they, like lions, like the big cats, they're all cowards. They want the easy kill. They try to pick off the lame animal. They try to pick off the baby that has no power, the baby water buffalo, or the baby gazelle. They try to catch people when they're vulnerable, like they do the wildebeest when they're laying down cabin and they can't get up. They kill them. Well, that's the way these people are. If you're strong, you're armed, in general, they'll leave you alone. I remember, I'll end with this story, back when, this has been 15 years ago, I got word from a friend, a lawyer, who had been in criminal defense in federal courts for years, and he said, Brent, this fellow that's Attorney General of the United States, his name was John Ashcroft, former senator from Missouri, former governor of Missouri, former Attorney General from Missouri, then became Attorney General of the United States, a Nazi at heart, proclaiming himself to be Christian, didn't have a clue what government is or was or ought to be because he was from a Christian group that believed in dictatorship, and very wrapped up in it. His father before him was as powerful in that group as he was. But he was holding seminars at that time over 15 years ago, seminars for all of the United States attorneys and all of the assistant United States attorneys, seminars on how to indict and convict and jail lawyers that practice criminal defense in the federal courts. And he did it. And after those years, I got an email from a friend that I'd gone to law school with, and he'd went to work for the IRS, and then he opened a division in St. Louis, a law firm defending people from the IRS. He understood it real well. I'm glad he got a change of heart. But he told me that the criteria that the Attorney General taught, the Attorney General of the United States was teaching all U.S. attorneys and their assistants, the criteria for prosecuting lawyers that practice criminal defense in the federal courts came down to about three things. Number one, did his tax returns reveal that he didn't make more than $40,000 3 years in a row? And was he alone, a sole practitioner? In other words, did he belong to a law firm? If he either belonged to a law firm, or he made over $40,000 in one of the three years previous to them wanting to indict him, then they wouldn't touch him. They'd leave him alone. Why? Because they figured if he belonged to a law firm, he had plenty of lawyers there and resources to defend himself. And they figured also, if he made over $40,000 in any year, 3 years running, he might, although doubtful, he might have enough money to hire criminal defense to help him. Well, they wanted to pick off the lawyers that were vulnerable, that didn't have any money, that were coming into court with threadbare and ragged suits, defending people who didn't have any money. They wanted to destroy them. That's the viciousness of the evil empire. No respect for the law, no respect for those that had taken an oath to commit themselves to the Constitution of the United States, namely, lawyers. Well, that's enough for this evening, I suppose. Thank you again, John. Glad to have you back. And I, of course, I'm always willing to take questions if you want me to take time to do that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had my mic muted there. Okay, we'll open up to some questions. Let me get to the board. Am I coming through, by the way?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Okay, let's open up the Q&A. All right, if anybody has any questions or comments for Brent, star six to get into the Q&A. And we've got Terry from Colorado. Go right ahead, Terry.
Hi, Brent. Thank you so much for coming and talking every week. I look forward to it. I'm still reading your book. I'm up to section 410, page 537. And this week I ran across one question that stuck in my head. Was it the stare decisis versus the common law jury's right to decide both the law and the facts of the case? If we are to have stare decisis, what allows us to nullify any rule that needs to be nullified in the opinion of the jury? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, if you could for me, I was listening, and I'm overwhelmed that you had the discipline to start in the beginning of that book and read it. Now, some people tell me they can't put it down. Others say they start in the middle and go both ways, but try to boil your question down to us. I understood what you're saying, but boil your question down to a sentence or two.
Okay. If we are to have stare decisis,
yes,
what allows us to nullify, what allows us, the jury, to nullify any rule? I see a problem there.
Oh, I see what you're saying. In other words, by what authority does the jury have a power to declare a law unconstitutional or to nullify a law or say, no, we're not following this law? And the authority to do that comes from God. The authority to do that comes from God. And we need to say it that way because, bottom line, here's what it comes down to. Let me repeat this. This is just a fundamental maxim, but it's true in every case. No man has jurisdiction to do wrong. Put it another way, no man has a right to do wrong, in government or out, regardless of what the state legislature says, regardless of what any court says. And some people say to me, well, but every time I try to get on the jury, they say you've got to take an oath that you will obey the instructions of the judge. So what do I do? If I don't take that oath, if I take that oath, I have to obey his instructions. And that's not true either. That is not true either. You have every right to assume and presume that the judge will give you lawful instructions. So you have every right to take that oath in good faith. But when you discover in your heart of hearts, and when you're on the jury, friends, neighbors, and relatives, it's you. You can't run off to your professor, your school teacher, your priest, your preacher, your spouse, and ask them, well, what do I do? You don't have jurisdiction to do that. Again, it's a fundamental right. It's non-delegable. It comes from God to you. You say, well, where in the Bible is the jury? 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 through 7. That's one place, and there are others where the principle set forth. But most clearly, it's set forth there in clear express terms. God has given us the right to judge. Well, what about judge not that you be not judged? Well, that bears some explaining. What Jesus Christ is talking about there in the Sermon on the Mount is relegating people to hell. And the word there, the Greek word, is that strong. And we need to make that distinction. We don't have, I don't have, you don't have, the Pope of Rome doesn't have, for crying out loud, of all people. Nobody has the right to relegate another man to hell. I know the Pope of Rome claims he has that jurisdiction. He doesn't. And to relegate another man to hell and then send him to hell and say he's sending him to hell. I remember we were that old movie with back when they used to do those miniseries, Western, I'm trying to think of it, Robert Duvall. They were hanging this fellow, who obviously deserved to be hanged if the story was true, but this fellow was mouthing off, and so he was sitting on his horse. And Robert Duvall takes his quirt and slaps the horse on the rump and says, talk your hell to the devil, and that you hung him. Well, that's relegating the man to hell. You shouldn't do that. Christ said don't do that. I'd rather do what Jesus Christ said. But when it comes to juries, they're not relegating the people to hell if they're doing the right thing. They're making judgment. They're inspecting the situation and delivering their opinion about what they believe is right. Pardon?
Can I insert something here? My problem was the conflict, because one of the bases of common law is stare decisis, that
yes.
if there is a court case before that.
Well, that's I understood that part of it. Maybe I needed to hit the nail more square on the head. It doesn't make any difference what what another case says that went before. We follow the guidance of those because that gives us some order and some uniformity, and without that, we're not a common law country. But it's abundantly apparent that courts make mistakes and juries make mistakes. And when you listen, what God wants us to do is he wants us to watch. He wants us to turn our head to the past and pay attention to what happened so that we can learn. And then he wants us to turn our head to the future and do what we know to be right in light of what we learned from the past. One of the things we learned from the past is juries are buffaloed by prosecutors. We learn that. Don't let yourself be one of those people. Let me give you an example. For instance, you've heard of the case Brown versus Board, back in the mid-50s. It was about the little girl down in Arkansas that they wouldn't let her into school because the color of her skin was wrong. They didn't like it. It was darker. And so President Eisenhower called out the National Guard. He did that so the governor, Faub, what was his name? Doesn't make any difference. He wanted to call out the National Guard because if the governor had called the National Guard out, the president couldn't have done it. So Eisenhower called them out quick and enforced what the Supreme Court had said. But what the Supreme Court said in that case overturned what the Supreme Court had said before. And they said, we're overturning, we were wrong before. So stare decisis is men trying to gain some uniformity, trying to force ourselves. Stare decisis forces ourselves to look into our past and try to gather wisdom from what we've experienced. And there is a strong presumption that what the courts have said, the juries have said in the past, should be followed. But that is a strong presumption, and every presumption is rebuttable. And if you believe in your heart of hearts that the case facing you as a juryman, that stare decisis, what was ruled before, should not be applied in this case, no matter what the judge has said, you have a duty, not an option, a duty to disregard whatever has gone before and judge according to your guts about what's going on now. And if that means deciding the facts this way and saying the law in this case doesn't fit and I'm not going to rule against this guy, that ends the matter. We have a long, speaking of our stare decisis, we have a long tradition of courts saying that juries have the power to overrule the law as well as the facts. They're in charge. Justice Holmes, left-wing wacko in some ways, he even acknowledged that, as has our Supreme Court consistently throughout. The only place we have problems with juries and people trying to intimidate juries, of course, is right in the jury trial and the local courts and the judges and trying to overturn jury opinions. I've seen it in the courts. It's unconscionable. I as a lawyer, I can't imagine why a judge, but they do it. They do everything they can to nullify, overturn, lessen the power of a jury decision. I wasn't involved in this case. I knew the lawyer well. He was involved in the case I was involved in when this happened to him. He went into federal court, and he argued on behalf of four prisoners who were denied medication the last 18 months they were in prison. Medication for, I can't think of the name of the disease, but it was the policy of the state government to just cut that medication off 18 months before they let you out. They did, four of them. And they sued and said, look, if you're going to jail us, you got to take care of us. You can't kill us. We didn't receive the death sentence. We received a jail sentence. Well, before the litigation was over, two of them died. And almost thought of the disease name. I'm sorry, I can't remember. But two of them died. The verdict came back, $2 million per man, or either to them, they two of them died, to their families. That had been a total of $8 million. Well, that's not too much for a man's life, and the two that didn't die, they'll never get over it, physically, mentally, emotionally, and neither will their families. The judge reduced it to a flat $20,000. That's it. That's called overturning a jury decision without technically overturning the jury decision. It's the same thing. You've nullified it. You've made it of no effect. As long as we got the jury, we'll have freedom. If we ever lose it, because the possibility continues, and men like you men and women like you, I should say. I'd include all of them. But they're all saying, what do I do? And I have people ask me this constantly. And they're buffaloed by the intimidation of the prosecutors. I'm not saying you are, of course, but a lot of them are. And they really, in their heart of hearts, they say, how can I take an oath to follow the instructions of the judge and then deny that oath? That would be lying to God, because you take an oath to God, of course, in your own mind. A lot of people do. I think they ought to. And by the matter of fact, the Bible says if you're going to take an oath, you don't take it to anybody but him. You don't ask anybody to come and visit judgment on you if you don't keep your oath. You ask him and him alone, and anything less is idolatry, attributing power to things that don't have that kind of authority, things or persons. But you have a duty. Let me get to this. This is what I wanted to get to, and I'm beating around the bush. You have a duty. Every man has a duty to disregard an oath that he finally understands is an oath to do wrong. No man has a right to do wrong. I don't care how many times you swore on the Bible to do it. You don't have a right to do wrong. And once you've discovered that your oath would entail you to do wrong, you have a duty before God to disregard your oath and move on and do the right thing. I often cite that example in the Bible, in the book of Acts. There were a passel of Jews who swore a blood oath to not eat or drink until they had killed Paul the Apostle, a former Pharisee. They hated him because he was a turncoat to them, and they decided, and they dogged him all his life, the Pharisees. They wanted to kill him. Might have got the job done. We don't know. But they swore a blood oath to kill him. Now, was that a lawful oath? Obviously not. Murder is unlawful. You take an oath to commit murder, and you follow through with it, if you choose to follow through, not choose to not follow through with it, you have done your duty before God. As a matter of fact, even our criminal law, our law of conspiracy, says if you've entered a conspiracy to commit a crime, and then you deny the conspiracy, and you tell the other conspirators, I'm out, as our law says, make a clean breast of it, then you're not prosecutable. That's it. That's the law. So there's something very important about denying, not following through on a commitment that you realize is lawless. So with stare decisis, to make it clear to people maybe are wondering about these fancy terms, stare decisis is the pole star of our common law. What it says is that when you have a court case, that decisions of previous court cases on similar facts are to be followed in successive cases after that. And it's based upon the idea that there's a thread of truth. Take cases of, civil rights cases, right to freedom of religion, right to freedom of speech. Those cases have a thread of truth that winds through them. And it's always the same, and we're to follow that thread of truth. I'm quoting Justice Mansfield on that. And he made a good point there. That's true. And so when it comes, that's what stare decisis is. Stare decisis is an old law French word. It means let the decision stand. Don't overturn the decision unless it is apparent that it's clearly absurd the way it's being applied. That's what happened with Brown versus Board back in the 50s. I told you about in Arkansas. It overturned that case that said separate but equal is okay. Well, they said, no, that's not true anymore. Separate but equal is inherently unequal. That's what the court said, Brown versus Board. So stare decisis, though, is that guiding pole. And what Brown versus Board said they were doing, they said the other case was wrong. We're getting our cases back in line with truth, back in line with stare decisis. And it is the pole star of common law. But if the courts declare something that's not true, as they did in that previous case before Brown versus Board, they said separate but equal is okay. They said that's wrong. The courts have a duty to correct themselves. That's just one example. I've read lots of cases where the courts have said, well, as we have ruled before, that's no longer in effect. We're changing our minds on that. We've made a mistake, and they changed their minds. A juryman has that same duty independent of what any judge tells him. Remember, a juryman that is independent of mind. A juryman is even independent in his thinking and his decision from all other jurymen. I mean, if you're the guy that's got to hang 11 other people, hang the jury, then you've got to hang the jury. That's your job. And don't you ever forget it. It's not the jury is not a majority institution. It doesn't operate on a majority principle. It's all or nothing. And one person can nix what the government does. Let's put it another way. The job of the jury, whether it be grand jury or petit jury, That means big jury or little jury, the trial jury. The job of the jury is to say yes to the government, yes, you may, or no, you may not. Grand jury, that means this. The grand jury has the power to say, yes, you may prosecute, take this person to trial, or no, you may not. The petit jury's job is to say, yes, you may take this man or this woman's life, liberty, or property, or combination thereof, or no, by golly, you may not. That's the job of the jury. You say, well, what about the grand jury? The grand jury doesn't, it's not an all-or-nothing institution. No, it isn't in the same way, but it is this, and watch me close on this. Regardless of how many members are on a grand jury, and at common law, it can be different numbers. There's really no set number, although most states now have rested on 23. But truth is, some in the past have been 30, some have been 15. But in every case throughout our history, whether it's been a grand jury, whether it's been 15, or whether it's been 50, and it's been that many in some cases, throughout our long centuries of history, in every case, it still took at least 12 to indict. If the grand jury was 50, it took 12 to indict. That's not a majority. If the grand jury was 30, it took 12 to indict. That's not a majority either. If the grand jury was 25, it took 12 to indict. If the grand jury was 15, it took 12 to indict. The number 12 is the key to the jury, whether it be grand jury or petit jury. So stare decisis is let the decision stand, and I hope I've enlightened some ideas about that. It doesn't make any difference what the judge does. The juryman has to do what he independently believes in his heart of hearts is right, regardless of what he has sworn to. Once
you
realize
Brent.
What's right.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Terry. Okay, let's take our next caller. Fred, go right ahead. You got the mic.
Hello, Brent. Can you hear me?
Very well. Thanks.
Okay. Sir, I had some questions there regarding the militia and the jury. President Clinton and Janet Reno rewrote the grand jury instructions for the federal grand jury during his administration. I believe a lot of that had to do with Monica and all of that. But is there any constitutional provision? Now, according to Judge
Hey,
Scalia...
Fred, who was it Fred, that you said rewrote the grand jury instructions?
It was President Clinton and Janet Reno.
They wrote the federal grand jury instructions?
Yes, sir, during his administration as president.
I was trying to find that out. I'm glad to hear that I now know who these people were.
Okay. Well, I have a...
What an abortion they made, huh?
Sir, I have a book that I downloaded that spells out the original grand jury instructions and then the altered grand jury instructions after they'd finished. But my question to Brent was this. By what constitutional authority does anyone write instructions for the grand jury, taking away their power and bridling them?
Well,
as a militia man, I need my duty.
I'm sorry, say that again.
As a member of the militia, I need to do my duty. And part of that is to renounce these scoundrels and take back the jury.
I'm with you. Okay, let's talk about what are jury instructions. Jury instructions are just that. That's a strong word, instructions. They're guidance for the jury. Jury instructions aren't binding on the jury, ultimately. Although, again, the oath, locally, a lot of times they'll say, you must swear that you'll follow these instructions. Well, every jury is entitled to the instructions of the judge, the charge of the judge. That's common law tradition. The judge instructs the jury or teaches them or tells them about the law. Or he says what he wants to say, and his instructions written are part of that. But that does not control the jury. The jury is entitled to what the judge thinks, and if they want to know what the judge thinks, then he's to give it to them. That's his job as the judge. That's part of our tradition. I don't quarrel about that. But what I do try to inculcate, build into people, is the idea that they're not bound to obey an unlawful oath, They're not bound to obey the instructions of the jury. I don't care whether Janet Reno, I don't know who the guy claims is the president. It makes no difference. The jury can stop the entire power of the government of the United States, the grand jury and the petit jury. In other words, as I said before, the jury has the power to say yes and the power to say no to all the force of the government. That's it. And the instructions, who knows where they come from? I wasn't aware of this either. And I know that when you go to trial, you set the judge sets down with the parties or the lawyers, whoever is representing the parties, and they come to an agreement about the jury instructions. That very reality there should teach us that people don't know what the instructions ought to be. If two lawyers and a judge, which makes three lawyers, have to sit down and fight over jury instructions, that tells me that it's not a close case on what the law or its application is in any given case. And that's the whole point about jury instructions. They do come to a conclusion. The judge has the final say on jury instructions. Now, in most states, jury instructions are their model jury instructions for everything that happens, every crime that could be committed. And when you go to trial, as I mentioned before, when you start into a criminal prosecution and you're the guy that's sitting on the hot seat, first thing you need to do is go to the jury instructions for that particular accusation, because they won't be changed much. They may be altered a little by the time the lawyers and the judge gets through with them. But they're already provided. The court already has them. And as you go through the trial, you have to know where they're trying to go. You've got to satisfy those instructions with your evidence, is the point I'm making. But don't worry about the federal grand jury instructions. What you need to know, if you're a grand juryman, what a fellow needs to know is, what is the law of the United States on this matter, and was it duly passed? For example, if you know that the IRS, for instance, is pushing a regulation that was not duly passed by the legislative powers, and that's routinely done now at all levels of government, state and federal, then you might want to take note of that and do what you think is right. And not only that, as a juryman, and I say this to the people that are listening, you have the power to persuade other jurymen. And if you're not doing that and you think you're right, then you're not doing your duty before God. You know, if all you can do in your personality, it allows you to do is just say no and not argue anything, you got to do that. If your personality allows you to say something, then say it. If you feel like people are intimidating you in a jury room because you don't agree with them, and that often happens, it can get real ugly. And if all you can do is just stand firm and not budge, maybe ask the sheriff's deputy to come in and get people off of you because they're threatening you. Do that. But whatever you can do to swing the influence that you have, whatever it is, stick to it. I find that most people can't even stay quiet and just be by themselves and do what they think they ought to do. They're too easily persuaded to go along with the crowd. And if there's anywhere in our country that we need independent men and women, it's on the jury.
Yeah, let me pipe in here. I'd like to respond a little bit to some of this also, because I just recently read both the federal jury handbook and the grand jury handbook, and they do put it out as instructions, and they keep beating certain drums through that whole process in both sides of these handbooks, and I found it very disturbing. And I was wondering who had written it. I'm very surprised. I can't believe Janet Reno and Bill Clinton got together to rewrite these things, and they got away with doing that. What we're going to do, as a matter of fact, that's going to become part of what we're going to be doing in the courts. We're going to be dealing with these instructions, these stupid handbooks, because it's subversion against the United States of America. It's subversion against our Constitution. It's subversion against we, the people. It takes away our power. It does not give us empowerment. It doesn't empower us. And we also are in the process of writing a handbook. Now, I wouldn't call it instructions, although it may be to some degree instructions, but basically it's a handbook. You know, things people should know. What can we do to tell the people to empower them? Same thing we're doing with sheriffs. You know, we don't want to tell the sheriff what to do and what they shouldn't do, but we need to tell them what they need to know and what they should really be, what their position should be. The position should always be on the side of liberty. Their position should always be on the side of the Constitution. Their position should always be behind the people and not behind the damn judge. The judge is the problem. The prosecutor is the problem. The government is the problem. And the sheriffs don't realize this. And as long as our courts are controlled by those groups of people, then they are just, fulfilling the will of the tyrant and not the will of the people. Until we, the people, can take it over, then it's proper for the sheriff to be obedient to the court. Of course, he still has duties. He has to serve his papers. He's got to do certain things, and we're going to cover all those things as time goes on with the sheriff. But going back to the people need to understand, especially the people today, because all of us are so damn ignorant of what we should be knowing. Only those who are now just becoming aware of these things and starting to read and looking to these things that National Liberty Alliance has been put together in order that we might become powerful, more powerful for our own destiny, our own decision-making, control of our own government. But people need to know that they have the power of nullification. They have to understand the idea of nullification. Jefferson spoke a lot about nullification. The Kentucky, The Kentucky Resolution spoke about nullification. We need to give that to the people in the handbook. We need to give them a little history, give them a little information, the power and the authority of the people. That we have government by consent of the people. And this is where you're consenting. You're consenting to the government whether you're going to say, yeah, we're going to indict, or no, we're not going to indict. Go away. Leave this guy alone. You get to decide, wait, this guy didn't do anything wrong. I'll let him go. You see, they need to understand the empowerment, and nobody, not even the judge, you've got to make it clear the judge can't get in between you and your decision. Okay? We need to let the people know they get to decide not only the facts, but also the law. They also get to decide what the end results of this whole thing. It's not about putting people in jail. It's about finding restitution for the injured party. That's what it's about. And so people need to be looking for that restitution, not for the fine that goes to the government. What does the government need any more money for to begin with, okay? No, we need to get restitution to the injured parties. We need that. Sometimes it may be a jail sentence. I got to really think about a lot of these things on what I might think would require a jail sentence, but everybody's got to think on these things. And we need to talk about those things. But generally speaking, looking, when someone has injured somebody, they need to fix that injury. And that's their duty, and that's the payment that needs to be done. So people need to know, they need to understand what due process is, and if people really are getting due process, they need to know what jurisdiction is. And this is what a handbook, in my opinion, should be. And again, I don't know that you'd call it instructions, but it would be a handbook to guide people and to instruct people in a way of our history and what common law is all about and what their true authority and their duty is and the responsibility they have when they sit in that room to make a decision whether they're going to indict or if they're making a decision whether they're going to convict. This is we need to make those points to them. And that's what should be in the handbook. We're going after to destroy those two handbooks. That's part of what our plan is that we'll be talking about over the next week or two. We're taking that into court. But we'll get more into details about that later.
I have other input. My crucial question was really this. The grand jury is sitting there. It's supposed to have the power to investigate. That's why Hillary Clinton is running wild, because they can't do anything and investigate on their own. They're at the mercy of these darn prosecutors.
Well, that's because we don't have a free jury, either grand or trial jury. They're puppet juries. They're controlled by either the prosecutor or the judge. Sheriffs, I've gone to sheriffs they broke the law right here. These are the statutes. You got to do something about it. And these are judges we're going after. Oh, I don't know if I could. Well, you better go talk to the prosecutor. You go talk to the prosecutor. The prosecutor says, no, we're not doing that. Okay, and what does the sheriff do? He goes along with the prosecutor. Why is that happening? Because it's ignorant. That's why it's happening. The sheriff needs to understand. He got to stop going begging to the prosecutor to do anything. Come to the people. Get your indictment and let's take it on. Let's take these judges down. Let's take these prosecutors down. Let's take all these tyrants down. That's what we need to do. And the sheriffs need to get a backbone. And that's why we started off tonight with the sheriff's power that only the people can remove the sheriff from office. A governor cannot remove a sheriff from office. There is a state, I just read about this recently, and I forget what state it was in, where the governor did remove a sheriff from office. That's not possible. It happened. How did they get away with that? Are we that dumb? Are we that stupid? And the answer to that, unfortunately, is yes, we are. It's our fault. And when we get these things going, the administrations, then it'll really be true freedom to the people, because anybody could take anything to the grand jury. They can take their investigation. It doesn't matter who you are. 2, 3, 4 people can get together, do an investigation, come in with something and say, hey, look, there's crimes going on. It needs to be dealt with. You take a look at it. Okay, bring it to the grand jury. Go tell the grand jury your story and let the grand jury make the decision. You see, the grand jury has to have an open door. And the grand jury has to be able to say, wait a second, something else going on. What's that over there? Can we go take a look at that? Sure you can. What do you need? You want us to get you access into the office? And that's what the administration will empower the grand jury to make sure those doors open, that they get to go to make that investigation, to make the phone call, say, hey, the grand jury's coming down. They're sending 3 representatives. They want to talk to you. Make sure they open the books. And if they want to go through your drawers or look in your computers, step aside. You see, that's the power of the people. We're the boss. We own the company, if you want to call it that. We own the books. We own the structures. We own the courts. We own the facilities. We pay for the phone bills. We pay for the faxes. We pay for the paper they write on, the printers, the computers, everything. We have a right to go through any of that at any given time. You'll never get that right now, and you'll never get a judge to go be brought up on any charges or a prosecutor unless they decide they want to throw them under the bus for one reason or another. If they're not going to throw them under the bus, you're not going to get you're not going to get anybody indicted there. Not with the system they got now, because we the people do not control the system at this moment in time, and that's what we're fighting for here at National Liberty Alliance, and that's what this next system that we're moving on may take us over that next hump. It definitely will start to put the pressure on them from another way. But anyway,
John, I believe that every jury, pettit or not, should have the ability, when they see something wrong in their courtroom with the judge or the prosecutor, they should be able to pass that information on to the grand jury and have them investigate it, stop the trial, and look for who they're going to prosecute.
Well, that definitely should be available, and that's something in a handbook that could be given. If you think that the judge has broken the law while you're sitting in the trial on judgment, you get a hold of the administrator, and they'll make sure they'll get that information to the grand jury. Okay? See, that's why the people have got to be the administrators. You can't have people that are controlled by a government or get a government check. The check has got to come out of it from a different place. They got to be paid from a different source. And there has to be, of course, the government has to give money to this administration in order, and they have to give an accounting just like anybody else does in government that gets government money. You got to give an accounting where this money goes to, and you got to create a budget and go through the whole process. We've already investigated how all that works. And we're writing down the layout, the plan on how people are going to be able to use the system and be able to have the system funded by the people through the government. But the bottom line is you're right. In the beginning, you know, I think part of the administrator's job is to stop into the courtroom and sit in the back to see what's going on. Because they're the ones that will be really most informed and see, whoa, what's this judge doing, you know? And you know, the administrator on his own, okay? You get another administrator to come with you, and after the court case later on, you give a call to the judge. Hey, judge, let's come up and talk to you for a few minutes. Oh, I'm too busy. Well, okay, I'll tell you what. We'll catch you for coffee in the morning. How's that? You make sure you get the guy, and you go over to him, you talk, and say, look, this is what you did in the courtroom. You broke the law here. You need to go fix that. You made an error. You know, we can give them a little bit of a leeway to fix their error and repent and do the right thing, because I think everyone deserves that to some degree. But not what these judges are doing today. You take this judge, I think Judge Brown out there in Oregon, that's ruling in the wildlife preserve case. I can't believe what I'm hearing coming off of that bench. I just can't believe what I'm hearing. It's like I'm on another planet. And, I mean, this woman has gone up and she's brought in an opposition as if she was the prosecutor, and then she turned around and sustained her position as a prosecutor. I mean, it's insane, and she's done it more than once. I mean, how do we go on with this insanity? People need to wake up. We need to do something about it, and we are going to do something about that and other things like that. But it's going to take the people to take control. And that's why, you know, when the questions are asked and you say, well, okay, you know, what can we do or where can we go? What are we going to do about it? Well, it's up to you. It's up to me. It's up to Stephanie and Jeremiah, who's after you. It's up to all the other people in this room and many other people that are part of what we're doing, or we're going to become part of what we're doing. It's up to everyone to do something. You got to go out and do the Committee of Safety. You got to go out and talk to your sheriff. You got to go out and become an administrator in your county. You got to do it. You got to become a committee man. You got to do it. I got to do it. We got to do it. But we can't say, well, here's the problem. What are we going to do about it? And then none of us do anything about it. We got to step up and get up to bat. And I'm telling
John?
You, and I say this every Monday night, with the time is running close. We're running out of time. This is the last call, maybe. We don't even know. We need to do something. We need to do something now. Because once they close that iron fist, you'll never get it open. You'll never get it open. We have to prevent them from closing that iron fist. That iron fist is martial law. When martial law is fully intact and under control, we are done. Finished and over. Just might as well check yourself in and, I don't know what else to say, but go ahead.
Okay. My thought is this. Why don't we write the instructions for the jury?
We are.
And include all kinds of things where the juries can talk to one another and indict the people in the courtroom. And why don't we introduce that as the memorandum of law in the case?
All right, well, I'll tell you what. I these are some of these ideas I didn't even think about that you brought up. I got a lot of ideas, and that's exactly what we're going to do. Why don't you send in, do we have a, you know what, we'll put up an email, which I'll announce next week, just an email address for the sole purpose of ideas. Matter of fact, we'll call it ideas@nationallibertyalliance.org. And people with ideas on handbook, okay, why don't we do this on a handbook, or make this point on a handbook, or that point on a handbook, or you got some other idea, okay? Let's get these ideas in an email, and then we're going to call some of these people that are bringing some of these ideas, and maybe you can work on committees to do things to help gather more information, or even help write and put together some of these things. Because there's a lot of work to be done, and we need a lot of people doing the work. And it's unfortunate, and I tell you, we don't have enough people. We just don't have enough people. I can't tell you how many things fall behind the wayside that I'd love to run with, and they just fall between the cracks, and I reach out to grab this, and you can't. You can only grab onto so much and do so much. So we have lots of stuff and lots of things to do, but the sad truth is we don't have enough people helping us to do it. So let's get the ideas going. And let's start there, and let's see if we can get more people involved. But I want to tell you, no matter what you do, there is no excuse for anyone, and I speak to myself first, no excuse at all whatsoever to not participate on your local community to work with your Committee of Safety. You still have, every single human being has to do that. We have to be part of that political, that body politic, okay, the true body politic that controls this government, that's controlling it by the will of the people, for what is right and not for what is wrong. So we all got to do that. And we all got to be at these meetings, especially when we meet up with the sheriff and stuff. We have to find the time to do it. Is America not worth that time? That's my question to everyone. Why aren't you doing it if you're not doing it? You know, we have thousands and thousands of members. We have tens of thousands of people that tune us in from time to time, that visit our website. We get a lot of hits. We got a very active website. And yet we don't have enough volunteers. What the hell is wrong with people? You know, look, here's the bottom line. Don't think the other guy is doing it. I'm telling you right now, he's not doing it because you're not doing it, or you're not doing it, or you're not doing it. Everybody else is thinking the other guy will do it. I got too much on my plate. I got a lot. I'm working two jobs, and I got to worry about my family and this. Well, that's not enough. You're not doing enough. No. If you got to work those two jobs, fine, but you can give an hour a week. You can give a couple hours a month. You can do that. Everyone can do that. If you want your country and you want your job and you want your money and you want your income and you want your house, you want your things or maybe a boat or something, if that's what you want, you need a free country to live in, to have those things so no one will take them away from you. And you want your children to be free, to be able to have free speech, to speak their peace and speak their mind, and no one shuts them up. If that's what you want, then you have to put time into it. And it doesn't matter how much time you're putting into your life. You need to put some time right here. Every person, every single person, we should be teaching our children at some point in time, you must become a committee man. Not that you must. If you don't, you don't. Big deal. Okay, fine. But shame on you. They should be shameful of themselves, ashamed that they didn't take 2 years of their life to sit up as a committee man, which only requires maybe 24 or 30 hours a year. I mean, my God, if you can't do that, what can't you do? Okay? And anybody who refuses to go to a jury, to sit on a jury or a grand jury, shame on you. Woe is you. We need to teach our children that it's a shameful thing not to pick up and do those things. That's what we need to do. And we will do that. That is part of the plan of National Liberty Alliance, which is education. We are going to the schools at some point in time. We can't do it now. I'd love to be in the schools right now. I'll tell you what. If all of our membership, if half of our membership tomorrow morning said, I want to get involved, we would be in the schools right now. We'd be doing so many things more than what we are doing. But just what we have to do and just what we must do is hard enough at this point because we don't have enough volunteers. What is wrong with the people that they're not getting up off their tired rear ends to do something to save the nation for themselves and their children and their neighbors and their friends? What is wrong with us? Have we become that complacent? I speak to myself first on a lot of these things. I had to push myself, and I still push myself. And everybody has to push themselves. I don't want to hear I'm working two jobs and it's hard. Don't tell me about it because I know how hard that is. I live in the same world, and I got the same problems, and I got my children and my family, my concerns, my problems, my worries. But I got to do what I got to do, just like you're doing what you got to do. Everybody's got to do it. And I am very disappointed sometimes that people just aren't stepping up to bat. It's like I feel sometimes that it doesn't matter if America goes. It's not that important. As long as I have what I have now, I guess now is be here now. I don't know. To hell with tomorrow. I don't know. I get we need to do something. We need to step up to bat. I guess I better get off my soapbox. Back to you, Fred.
Sir, I was only bringing this all up because you're going to file some papers. And I think the papers ought to be so explosive, they're going to want to kick it out of the courtroom.
You bet. You bet they are.
It's going to be like 240 volts. Once you grab it, you want to let go, but you can't.
It's going to be like 600 volts. We're going for three phases here. So.
Amen.
But,
okay,
I'm all with you on this, Fred. We got to do something with these books, and we are damn well going to do something with these books. Now I understand how I looked at this book, and I saw the psychology in these books, these federal books for grand jury and trial jury, and I read through them, and I took notes, and I saw the same things running through the whole thing, and it's all about control. It's all about the prosecutor controlling. It's all about the judge controlling. It's all about what they say. It has nothing to do with the law. It's an abomination is what it is. It's depressing. We're going to fix it. We're going to expose it in the courts. Shame on these people. Because you know what? The people who wrote that book are guilty of subversion against the United States of America. And you know what? Since those two people wrote those books, how is Janet DiReno doing? Is she still with us?
I'm not sure, but she looks very ill.
Well, I know Bill Clinton doesn't look that good either, but maybe we should bring them into court because they wrote that book.
Well, you know how he got his surplus during his presidency?
I'm sorry?
It's really simple. Bill Clinton got a surplus during his presidency. You know how he did it?
No.
He started issuing Social Security numbers at birth rather than when you apply for a work permit at 16 or get a job at 18.
Oh, that's when that started, yeah.
That's who did it. And that's how he got his surplus, because he was able to tap all of these children in America and start spending their wealth during his administration.
Wow.
That's how evil and smart that guy
yeah,
is.
Yeah, these people, they're well, look at the people behind him, you know, is what it really is. But they're puppets themselves, I think.
Sir,
but
I
anyway.
Do not wanna
all right, anything
all
else, Fred?
Huh? No, sir, I am just chomping at the bit to send you information, though.
Yeah, I am going to create the email. I'll do it tomorrow morning. Don't send it out till tomorrow, let's say after dinner or something. But I want to make a note for myself to create the email. And then the name of the email is ideas@nationallibertyalliance.org. And anybody that's got good ideas, let's send it into that email. And we're going to start working on those ideas. But get ready for some of you to get a phone call, because some of your ideas might be so big and so great and that we need to put people together, a committee together to do it, and we'll ask you to work, maybe lead or work with others to lead the committee or whatever you want to do. But let's do it. You know?
Another thing is people that are convicted of a felony, you know, back in the old days, they got out of prison, they gave them their guns back. And they could go to another state and have a fresh start. I would like to see felons on the jury, because, by God, the cops wouldn't get by with what they do.
That's right. Well, look, once the person has paid the whatever the penalty is that's necessary to pay, it's done. And you can't take away an individual's rights. Yeah, they may lose their rights to some degree in society because they've done evil for a period of time until they made their repentance. Or their penance, or whatever you want to call it, but restitution, restore the injury that they made. But there's no reason why they can't have every single right, the right to have a weapon, the right to sit on a jury, or any of those things. We have to bring them back. If you keep shunning the people, and you keep putting them in jail, and sticking criminals with criminals, and isolate them, they're going to become what their environment creates of them. They're going to become criminals. If you shun them out. I do know a couple of hardened, really hardened criminals, and they have nothing in their minds that they're not going to change. And you know why? Because they've lost everything already. I can't play in the real world no more. I'm going to do what I got to do another way. And they do it, and they're going to die doing it. And there's a lot of people out there that are like that. And that's the problem. We created that problem. So... And everything that some people do is not, it's ridiculous that everything's a jail sentence. What's wrong with us? And the victim is always thrown out in the streets. Every single time. The victim gets absolutely nothing, tossed out into the streets. What's wrong with us? All right, let me go to the next person. Thanks a lot, Fred.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Okay, Stephanie, you got a question or a comment for Brent?
Yes, this is South Dakota Stephanie. Thank you. God bless you guys. Yes, I have a question for Brent. I was listening to Liberty Works Radio Network that he does, and then been reading the Excellence in Common Law, and then started the commentaries of the England one, William Blackstone, to start with getting a basis. And he had mentioned something about corporations are dead and you should dissolve from them, and so should the churches. And so, like ICAM, couldn't we dissolve from that and then have where you have your Austrian economics, like your Mises theory, where it's free, it's basically free government, I mean, you know, free market, instead of government-controlled monopoly like that?
Well, in response to your question about the corporation, I'll direct you to commonlawyer.com, the website, and then go to the media page. And on the media page are a couple of hundred MP3 audio clips, and somewhere in there is a series of 10 or 11 7 or 8 minute clips on corporations. And if you want to know more about corporations, I did those clips after escaping the heat of madness of scam artists that had been using corporation souls to steal real property. And the fellow that I had come in contact with, by the way, is the man that's responsible for getting Kent Hovind sent to prison. He's still running loose. The feds let him run loose because he's helping them, and they got him on a leash. He's presently under a federal restraining order. He's been under for 10 years. They refused to enforce because he's doing such a good job for them, and he sucked Kent into his web and destroyed him. Kent got 10 years, and this guy is still running loose. But at any rate, I'd had a contact with him, and he had some people I knew. He'd stolen a ranch from one of them, and he did it through a means of one of these lifeless corpses called corporations, and I call them golems. They're golem is a medieval rabbinic word that talks about a creature that a man, a rabbi, could create to do his dirty deeds for him so he wouldn't get blamed. And that's what corporations are. They become the dirty deed. Oh, it wasn't us. It was a corporation. Well, the corporation doesn't exist. Just because the government says it exists doesn't mean it does. Of course, whatever the government creates, and the government creates corporations, LLCs, LLPs, S-Corps, C-Corps, whatever the government creates, it has the power to control and limit its jurisdiction, and it does. That's why it's so important that people do not wrap a corporation around a church, because once you do that, you put your church under control of the government, because when it gives permission to have the incorporation, and the government signs off, and the Secretary of State signs off, under legislation provided for that, to incorporate, wrap a corporation around a church, with that becomes a list of powers in your corporate documents. And those list of powers may preclude you from doing anything the government says is not lawful. Well, as you know, the government can say anything is not lawful. It may or may not be lawful, but if they say it's not lawful, then they can shut down your church and keep you from saying what you want to say, publishing what you want to publish. Don't do that. Don't incorporate your church. That's kind of the response to that. If that does that get what you were asking about?
Yes, that does. I wanted some clarification, because I was taking it that if you do have a corporation, a person should dissolve it, right?
Well, especially a church. Now, there are a lot of things that come into play here. I talked to a fellow not too long ago. It was arguably, he's a corporate office for the largest corporate officer for the largest set of ministries in America, called ministries. And the reason that the ministry has become so large is because of the corporate monopoly that the government grants them, and because they do the government's bidding in many ways, and because the tax code, the 501c3 that goes with the corporation, enables these mega ministries. And be wary of all of them. They love the tax code, these big, big mega churches and mega ministries. And they are what they are because of the tax code. When I was growing up, nobody ever heard of such a thing. And the reason was because people hadn't caught on the tax code, the 501c3, didn't come into play until after I was around, and people didn't catch on to it. But now they've caught on to it, and what they can do using the power of the monopoly of government to create mega churches and massive, quote, end quote, as it were, ministries. But that's all because of corporate power. God doesn't give government that power. God doesn't give government that power. I don't think that power should be used. It becomes a part of government power to do that. Of course, the government has now the electric co-ops and the TVA and the Columbia Valley Authority and all those well-known corporations that say they want to partner with the private sector. Well, what that means is the government controls everything and fleeces people. But go to those recordings, and maybe you can pick something up from there. One other thing I wanted to mention, before I forget it, talking about grand juries and the power of them and the previous caller, grand juries do have the power to prosecute the prosecutor that tries to control them. It's not that grand juries are at the mercy of prosecutors. They just don't know anything. And back during the days of Prohibition, much is said about the idea that juries, petit juries, trial juries, refused to convict moonshiners and folk like that, and that's why Prohibition was repealed. And that's true. The juries just wouldn't go along with the law anymore. They nullified it. They said, we're not following this. We don't care if you say it's part of the Constitution. It's not constitutional. It turns the Constitution on its head. And then the grand juries did the same thing, and they started investigating the prosecutors that were trying to prosecute the cases. Because in most cases, where there's drugs and where there's moonshine, and I can tell you this for a fact, I've seen it, and drugs and moonshine go together in at least half the country. And where those things are, the judges often are caught up in the organized crime of it, as are the prosecutors. And it creates a real messy situation, just like this fellow down in, Alabama was, this sheriff that was removed from office. Well, that happens more often than we like to think about. Sheriffs get involved with organized crime. And that includes monopoly for enforced trade enforced by the sheriff. But the point I'm getting to is prosecutors do not lawfully have control of grand juries. The Hyde Commission did a study of the thing back when Henry Hyde was head of the Judiciary Committee back in the 90s, and his conclusion was that a federal prosecutor with a federal grand jury could indict even a ham sandwich. He could indict a ham sandwich. Well, that's true. And that's because jurymen don't know that when they see something go wrong, grand jurymen, the prosecutor thinks being too aggressive, they can say, they can tell the judge, listen, send a message to him, we want all of the files of this prosecutor, we want them right now. There's something stinks here. And if he's found guilty of a crime, that's what happened back during the days of Prohibition. They called them runaway grand juries. Runaway grand juries, because the prosecutors said it was as though they were a team of horses that the grand jurymen were whipping without holding the reins, and they were prosecuting people they shouldn't be prosecuting. Well, that wasn't it at all. They were prosecuting who they wanted to prosecute. They weren't runaway grand juries. They were grand juries doing their job. They were saying yes to the government where they thought it was appropriate, but it got so bad that in most cases they were saying to the government, no, you may not indict this person, and by the way, we're changing the investigation here. We want your records, and we want all your files, and we want the files of how you came about to have this beautiful home you live in, being on a half-time salary, or whatever it was. We want the files of your bank, we want your bank account files of you personally. That's what we want. And all the people that work for you, by the way, and we want to make sure they're not being paid off. That's what happened. That's what can still happen. That's still the law in America. But you see, people like Bill Clinton and that crazy, what was that gal's name, Janet Reno. Man, they just said, well, nobody's doing this. We'll just do it and nobody will question it. That really happens. Happens a lot in government until somebody calls them out. Go ahead if someone wants to talk.
That brings to a point. Because just like in South Dakota, we have a lot of Native American tribes, and throughout the United States, you know, they've got what they're looking at is, and we're seeing what we can do about some jurisdiction and how we can get everybody involved on the same page. The Apache stronghold formed in December in response to a last-minute legislative provision included in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2015, and it gave the provision at issue, the annual Defense Department funding bill grants the Resolution Copper Mine a subsidiary of Austrian English Mining. Well, we in South Dakota, they had similar things here, but it was with the Chinese and the Russians, and so they were using those bills plus your windmill Clean Energy Act things to enact and take, well, in the pipeline, which is a monopoly, and it's tied to the teacher's retirement, and it's tied to locking all the prisoners up and getting money for cash. There's private contractors getting money for cash. You know, and we're looking at, I want to see here, 566 federally recognized tribes that, you know, are having the same problem with the government taking over their land. So there should be something we can do to organize that would be, you know, very workable and doable. What do you suggest?
I suggest that you concentrate locally on committees of safety. I think that's a great idea. Because that's the thing that organizes people, awakens them to the idea that if you, as members of that committee, or just citizens that are aware of what's going on because of the Committee of Safety, you're aware of what they're doing, they don't have authority to do it, and you want to stop them. There are several ways you can stop them. you can raise it through the press is one way if it gets bad enough. But there are other ways to do it too. This is out of hand, and we're watching right now a ground. I realize your problem is local. By the way, are you in the east or the west of the state?
West.
Where clear west to the border of Montana, or where are you?
No, Rapid City. Rapid City.
Oh, okay. Now I understand a little bit of that problem, and the Indian tribes are being used as an entry into taking over land, and that means power. And I'm aware of what's going on some in Montana. I have friends there. Also, what you mentioned about the Chinese and the Russians, I know that's true. I've been involved in mining business in Montana, and the Chinese have taken interest through corporations. See, they've got their golem. They've got their false face. They put in there, oh, this is a corporation. This isn't the Chinese shareholders. It's a government of China, what it is. And they control the largest of the copper mines, which also have a great gravy business in gold and silver always, pit mines there in Nevada. Yeah, we're in bad shape. And the way to deal with that is locally. We're watching a groundswell. People do, as our Declaration of 76 says, they put up with a lot before they say something. But people were so refreshed and they were empowered. And I've watched long enough to see that if one man happens to be, if the time is right and the man is right and he falls in the right position by the providence of God, that's what appears to be happening with this fellow named Trump, and he says something that confronts the evil empire and the Jezebels of the evil empire and those who follow them, and that's what he did last night, what that does is it encourages people who are right-headed. And we should be encouraged, whether he's God's man or not, I don't know. I just know this. Everybody belongs to God's providence, and nobody's going to get out of doing what going to get out of God using them for his purposes, whether they like it or not. And that's what's happening. And recognize that. Be encouraged, though, that God is involved in the affairs of men, and we should be encouraged locally, and you calling in. I perceive that you really do understand what's going on. I can tell by the way you talk and the things you've said. But what needs to be done, again, you just got to start by local awareness. It comes down to me and you doing right and not doing wrong. And no man has jurisdiction, no man has right, no to do wrong. And so we must individually do right. And there is no limit to the power of one fella doing the right thing and demanding the right thing. It comes in words. You got to demand it, too. Don't underestimate your power to say what is right and to do what is right. I like to say that when Noah didn't try to save the human race, the race of Adam. He didn't try to do that. He tried to save his family. But in saving his family, he saved the entire human race. And that's the MO of the God of all creation. So you concentrate. Here's what I suggest you do. I suggest this to everybody. I suggest it to myself. I call it the Noah principle. You concentrate on putting another plank in the ark for you and yours and those for whom you're responsible. Start with yourself and your family. And I know you're doing that. But we get to thinking that there's something we can do to just save the world. And if we try to do that, we're no better than the communists and the Trotskys and the Lenins of the world. That's what they tried to do. And the Marxists, they tried to save the world. But they lost their own families. I think four of Karl Marx's daughters committed suicide. And he didn't save the world either. So we need to concentrate, of course, in just simply doing what God tells us to do. The only remedy to this lawlessness that we see, it is utter. It's out of control. It's the glorification of pedophilia, the glorification of bribery, the glorification of actors in government who are able to fool people, and they're extolled for their ability. She said last night, I heard her say it, misquoting Lincoln, said, well, you know, that's part of politics. You say one thing to this group of people, you say another thing. We admire that. Well, in some circles they do. That's called actors. It's called hypocritos, you hypocrites. That's what you do. Well, we're not to do that. We're not to live in that world. We've gotten to that point where we're extolling that kind of culture of thespianism, of stage actors. I want no part of it. I hope you don't either. We want to live in reality, not fantasy. And if we live in fantasy, we will be destroyed. We must come back to reality. That means me and God doing my fundamental duty, and that's what I would suggest you do. you're doing it. You're listening. And I am too. I'm learning things from the folks that call in. I'm with you. I'm just trying to be right-headed and keep going down the same road.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I agree.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie. We'll take our next caller. Let's see. It is Jeremiah. Go right ahead, Jeremiah. You got the mic. You got a question or a comment? Jeremiah. Jeremiah. You got the mic. Last call from Jeremiah. Okay. 516 area code. Maybe you can give us your first name and your state.
My name is David. It's New York.
David from New York. Go right ahead, David.
Okay, well, I'm curious about what we spoke earlier about if the jury has the power to stop the government, then couldn't we just, if in a state where we have a common law judge and a common law grand jury established and maybe a common law sheriff, if we have all those components in one state, couldn't we start to bring charges against the government for certain wrongdoings that are
I'd like to say that we can bring charges against the government for wrongdoing right now. We have the right of redress. You know, what was it? Robert Schultz did a redress of grievances, and he took it to the Supreme Court. And it took it to the federal courts, it took it up to the Supreme Court. And the bottom line, the answer was that you can ask for redress of grievances, but they don't have to answer. That was the answer that they gave him. And he approached that whole thing wrong. But we're going to do the same thing, but we're not going to approach it. We're going to go in with the fact of the matter. We have the right of redress of grievances. They need to answer us. And if you want to remain silent, silence is fraud. And that's it. You're going to then default, and whatever it is that we write up, that's going to be the penalty. And we're going to give a lot of thought to that. That's part of what we're planning to do, by the way. And we will be talking about these things in detail either Thursday night or Tuesday night, depending if we can get the paperwork, everything written up tomorrow and prepare it, and then we'll try to do it Thursday. The sooner the better. But that is part of what we need to do. We are a common law people. We're a common law nation. The beginning of this nation was with the Declaration of Independence. Everything is built upon. That's the foundation, ultimately. We then created a Constitution, a capstone Bill of Rights. And we've given certain authority to our legislators to write certain law within a criteria. They're not permitted to go outside the jurisdiction that we've given them to write within. They're not able to change those things. They can't give themselves more power. They can't give their power away to another. I mean, somehow, how is it that the President of the United States, where did he get the power and the authority to go about and turn around and say, well, okay, I'm going to take ICANN, and we're going to give control of that over to the United Nations. Wait a second. Who made him king? Who gave him the decision-making? Where in the Constitution does he have that authority? And he doesn't. And you know what? No one said anything. They're complaining. They're bitching and they're moaning up there in Congress and the Senate because they know there's something wrong, and they're probably doing it all for the wrong reasons anyway, probably all for political reasons. I don't know what they're doing it for. But nevertheless, how come they're not asking the right question? Wait a second, you don't have the power to do that. Who are you that you think you can give this away? You see, we got to turn this whole thing around. We got to come in there talking with authority, bringing up the facts, telling the truth the way it is, revealing their darkness, and demanding an answer. Who gave you that power? Who gave you that authority? Why did you do this? How come you took that away from that person? How come you did not give this person their due process? You know, we have numerous, and I haven't even counted them, but it's got to be 30 or 40. I don't know the number. Habeas corpus is out there, and only two of them have succeeded through the process. Well, wait a second. Habeas corpus is a statutory process created in the courts ultimately to back up the Constitution ultimately, and I know it came before our Constitution, but nevertheless our unalienable right of due process, because habeas corpus is due process. All we're saying is, wait a second, you want to come and put me in jail for something, and you're saying that I did something wrong. I want the person in front of me, I want them to put their hand on that Bible and swear an oath that what they're saying is true, and then tell me what it is that you're claiming me to do wrong. They will never do that. All of these cases go without any kind of affidavits. Rarely do you see affidavits in the courts, especially in criminal cases. Very rarely. Okay? They just don't make the sworn statements anymore. And, they may get into the court and do certain things, but, the whole process is nothing but just, it's just horrific, to be honest with you. But the bottom line, if they're not going to come up and show by what cause this person, they're holding this person in jail for, and they can't deliver a sworn affidavit that this person has committed some kind of a crime and some kind of proof, they need to let him go. And all of the cases that we have put in for habeas corpuses, none of them have any kind of a sworn statement or anything against them. It's just hearsay evidence sitting in a courtroom, meaning nothing, absolutely nothing. And so these are other things that need to be dealt with. We've established the fact that the judiciary is negligent to what they should be doing. They're denying the people consistently across this entire nation due process in every federal court in every district. That's what they're doing everywhere. And every time we go into the courtroom, it's the same thing. We see these cases, and they'll spend 6 months to a year whittling down the witnesses, getting rid of the defendant is trying to build. They'll destroy it, and before you know, here's the defendant sitting in the courtroom at the end of the day, listening to all of these accusations, and he has no witnesses. He has nothing. Why? Because the judge threw it all out. There's endless cases that we can go into and show you about how this is going on. And this is what's going on in every federal district in America. And it's going on in our state courts, too. And, you know, how is it that these courts that are not courts, these administrative courts, put people in jail for a year? What's that all about? Where do they get that power or authority to take away the freedom of an individual without due process? And they turn around and they say, today, now, right now, the federal courts say, don't bring up the Constitution in the courtroom. The federal courts say it. The judges, we have a Judge Brown right now who said it numerous times, I'm not going to let you bring that Constitution in here. Don't read that Constitution. And the people, you know, we should be there with our rakes and shovels and hammers and whatever. You know, this is insane. Pitchforks, it's insane that we've gotten this far and the people are doing nothing. We know what's going on. We got to do something. We see it, and we're going to do something, and we're going to count on the people. The success of what we're going to be doing in the courts over the course of the next couple of months is going to depend upon the membership of National Liberty Alliance and upon the following that we have tens of thousands of people that are not members of National Liberty Alliance that visit our site constantly all day long. Those people, we're counting on them to make it happen because we need critical mass. We're going to put it together, we're going to put that spearhead, and we're going to put it right into the heart of the beast. And they're not going to be able to pull that out unless the people are not behind it, holding it in. So it's up to the people to get behind what we're doing. We're going to need the mass. And time is over, so you know there is no more time. It's now time to go forward with some really serious court cases. Anyway, back to you.
Well, there was something I wanted to mention, and that was this, that the callers asked about, he said, well, in New York, we've got, if we have a common law sheriff, a common law jury, a common law judge, well, you may...
I'd move to that county.
Pardon?
I'd move to that county.
That'd be the first move you ought to make, that's right. But all that stuff... If you have an inkling of the common law, you know, little as much if God is in it. That's true, no question about it. And a little bit of right doing right will cover a multitude of lawlessness, the Bible says, and that's true also. And if you have an inkling of the common law, grab hold of it and make it work for you. But if the grand jury is convened, the grand jury can really do about anything they want. You know, even the rules of evidence, traditionally, I know at the federal level they don't, probably in most states, the rules of evidence don't apply to the grand jury. They can do anything they want. And they once the grand jury is impaneled, they can bring to their attention anything they want to bring to their attention. And we're forgetting that. And
that's the boss coming out and straightening things up.
Yeah. And if you want to send an affidavit to the grand jury or a statement or a suggestion, I don't know why you can't do that. And I've known but the question is, exactly how do you do it? Do you send it to the judge's office to be delivered to the grand jury? I have known people. I'm thinking specifically of Kent Hovind, because I knew the lawyer that represented him for a while, and then I knew the lawyer that represented his wife all through the proceedings. But the lawyer that represented him at first, the first thing he did was filed an affidavit with the grand jury that Kent had written up and signed. It was a long one to explain what had happened to him, because he had heard that they were investigating him. So he communicated with them. That's what ought to be done more. But if you know a grand jury is in session, of course, I know grand juries are often secret. I don't know the rules in your state, and I don't know the rule of the local customs anywhere. I just know that it does happen sometimes, and that's something that should be looked into. How do you do that? Is it possible to make a suggestion to the grand jury about something that ought to be investigated? Now, out in California, not too many years ago, I had spent some time out here in the northern part of the state, and the grand jury was convened, and it's a rural county up here. Grand jury was convened to investigate the state of the prisoners in the county jail. And they were convened for at least 6 months. I knew one of the folks that was on the grand jury doing that investigation. That's all they were convened for. And I think they convened that grand jury to satisfy the screamings of the folk in the county that were complaining the way the prisoners were being treated. So they did at least do that. Well, the grand jury worked a long time, wrote up their conclusions, and delivered them to the sheriff. But nobody followed up on it, and so no changes were made. See, it takes more than just going through the motions. Now, the common law in our own country, starting back with in the 1890s, coming forward by some very conservative Supreme Court, like Hughes, Supreme Court justices, they came up with the idea they called substantive due process. No, due process is the process, the course of process that you're supposed to follow, the how you do things more than what you're doing or what you're trying to get done. Just follow the procedure. Well, they came up with this idea called substantive due process, and I understand what they're saying. It's hard to grasp, but it's simple, really. All they're saying is this. Substantive due process says this. It says going through the motions of due process isn't enough. It has to be genuine. It has to be genuine. In other words, we say, for example, in English, we say due process is summed up in these words. Notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard. Not an opportunity to be heard. A meaningful opportunity to be heard. That means the judge really listens, and he contemplates and weighs it out. And he doesn't just say, I weighed it out, and here's my conclusions. He really did. And if he leaves any evidence that he didn't do that, then he needs to be gone after, and there needs to be an appeal. There needs to be a motion made to reconsider something, whatever legal, lawful petitions are available to do that. But the grand jury, bottom line, to sum up the point, the grand jury has the power to do anything it wants. Don't say that it's under anybody's control. It's not. They're just ignorant and cowed. They don't know any better. And so I was involved in the case once, and I read the grand jury manuscripts. They come out during the trial. And I noticed one grand juror said, the U.S. prosecutor said, well, you just tell us what it is, and we trust you. Get us what we need. We trust you. And what he was saying was, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to be a rubber stamp for you. And most grand juries at the federal level, I'm speaking, don't know the state level as much, although I suspect it's about the same, are rubber stamps for prosecutors. That means the rubber stamp for the government. And they're not supposed to be. Listen, if we trusted the government, if we trusted prosecutors, if we trusted judges, we wouldn't have... We have need for juries. Juries are the badge of our distrust of men. Well, what does it say on our dollar bills? What does it say on our coins? In God we trust, by act of Congress, our national motto. In God we trust. We do not trust other men, in government or out. And we do not, as the Apostle Paul says, I don't trust what you Corinthians say about me. I don't even trust what I say about myself. I trust only God's evaluation of me. That's Americanism. And that's why we have that on our coins. Because we are not, here's another phrase from our common law in America, an expression in America from our earliest days, from Massachusetts, their original constitution. We are not a government of laws. We are not the government of men. We are a government of law. We don't trust men. We're not supposed to trust men. God says you're not even supposed to trust yourself. A loyalty, that's quite another matter. We are to be loyal to those of like kindred mind and spirit. Loyal. Loyal to ourselves even, and loyal to our friends, our fellows. But trust, that's reserved only for God. And the grand jury is the badge of America. And it's the badge of the English-speaking world. No, they don't have the grand jury, believe it or not, in England anymore. Are we headed that way? Well, we've written it in our written constitution. That's why we still have it. They haven't had it in England since the 1930s, believe it or not. But that's the badge of our distrust of men. So let's remember the jury has the power, the grand jury has the power to investigate anything they want to investigate. And we have the right and the duty to inform the grand jury within the procedures of our common law. You have to find out what those are locally.
Well, amen, and that's what we intend on doing here at National Liberty Alliance, is getting that word out to people, that it's the people that have the power. You know, the big problem is they've really tightened down the hatches on this. To get access to the grand jury is almost impossible in most places. We see a case down and we were involved in this case until some rogue people took control and totally destroyed. This guy's probably going to spend the rest of his life in jail. I don't know where his case is at. Last time we spoke with him, we told him that if he wants us to help, we'll help. But he went down the wrong road, did the wrong thing. He started to play the man on the land stuff as a grand jurist. Okay, you can't do that kind of silly stuff. And on top of that, he started to do things in a way that he shouldn't have done it. And as he was going out, he was going after corruption in the government. And now he's facing years in jail, and he's an elderly guy. The term that they got up against him, he's not going to be able to survive. So he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail, most likely. I don't know where that case is at. We should look in to see where that's at. We had another case out west. I'm trying to remember where this was. It might have been Montana or someplace, Wyoming. I don't remember. Someplace out west there. And the guy's name was Commander Walt. At least that's what I knew him by. And he had some evidence concerning subversion. And he was trying to get to the federal grand jury. And he was there was a guy that was, he was a lawyer, and he's called himself the foreman for the grand jury. He's been a foreman for 2 years. He's a lawyer and being paid to be a foreman for the grand jury. Go figure that out. And and he replaced the guy that was before him many years before him. And I don't know whether that guy was a lawyer or not. But anyway, this Commander Walt guy, he came out of the service and he had some information and he wanted to bring it before a federal grand jury. And this guy did everything he could to prevent him from seeing the grand jury. And he spent month after month after month. Then they started going out after him. And he's in jail right now, and his charges were stalking the grand jury. That's what they got him for, trying to talk to the grand jury to bring information that he had so that the grand jury could make a decision. But
I'm glad you brought that up, John. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, and I want to reiterate that also, echo it again, that whatever you do, you must do it according to the proper courses, the courses of the law that are established, and that takes a lot of looking to see that you do, because it's dangerous out there, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Very, very dangerous. So anyway, look, at this is why we, the people, have to do something. This belongs to us. This is our nation. They have no control over we, the people. They have no control over the grand jury. Go read United States versus Williams, what Scalia had brought up, of all the information that he had brought up in that one case concerning the power, the authority, and that no one controls them. They can do whatever they please. And that's where we got to take it to. We, the people, unconnected to the political powers, unconnected without bias, taking an oath before God, a vow to God, that we're going to act with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy, and we're going to bring the truth to these people so that they have the necessary tools to go in and be a grand or a trial jury for whatever it is that they're doing, whatever cases that they have to hear. And this is our duty, and this is our call. And by the way, we're still looking for four people in every county to take on this administration. And if you want to sign up for that, go into the course and sign up on the course to be an administrator in your county. You have to get through the two courses that we have here at National Liberty Alliance. One is on the Constitution, the other is on civics. All right, we only got about 1 minute left, so I'm going to move on to the next caller. We only got a short time, so Alan from North Carolina, what do you got?
Hey, John, this is Alan. Question is, with what was spoken of about what's going out in Oregon and stuff, what are we going to do to move now to change and stop the illegal activity that's going on? We talk about it and say what we're going to do, but I believe that, as they say, the iron's hot, and these guys are being criminalized, so we need to join forces and stop this.
Right. Well, now. Look, everything in due time. And again, you know, there's so much we want to do, and, you know, we now are no longer doing habeas corpuses, at least not until further notice. We're going to finish the ones that we've started, but we just don't have the time. We don't have the manpower. We just not enough hours in a day. But we're going to stick to our focus on where we really need to be. We are right now in the perfect position to make the next move. And everything, you know, has to be done in the right time. And sometimes things, you know, things we're doing sometimes, it's not revealed to us until the last minute. All of a sudden, whoa, wait, look, we should be doing this. Yeah, let's go. And we make a move. And that's kind of where we're at right now. We got so many things coming together. It's like the perfect storm across the nation. What we see and what we're doing and what cases that we're going to be pulling up, it's like the perfect storm that is coming together, and we need to take control of that storm. This needs to be the storm of judgment against these people. And we think that we're going to be able to pull that off. One of the big problems we do have, and we're going to have to go after these people, is news media. News media, they're lowlifes. They really, really are lowlife. These editors are enemies of the people. They're enemies of the United States. They're not doing their job. They refuse to print the stories. We have let some... every time we do something, we alert. I had I think it was 8,000 news medias across the nation, 7,800 and something. But anyway, we had just pulled a whole bunch of new ones in. It turns out we got about 5,000, okay, that are real actual emails that we can get news media information out. And we do have, I think we have some faxes also. I have to double check on that, but I'm pretty sure we do, and we have been faxing out to them too. But we're emailing to these news media, about 5,000 news medias across the nation, the things that we're doing here as the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. And I don't read nothing anywhere. These people are not picking it up. They're not running with it. We talked about subversion against the United States of America for enemies foreign and domestic. We talked about martial law coming to America and warning. And we've written the papers and filed it in the courts for, against Congress and against the Senate and the judiciary, the federal judiciary and so on. And the news media is not running with it anywhere. What's going on there? We have a major problem. I'll tell you what, at the end of the day, I'm going to make it my business to go on to a, you know, to just move forward with saying these newspapers, these people who have controlled the news media, they need to lose their licenses, their permits, or whatever they call it. I guess it's a license. We need to take it away from them and start all fresh, because these people, matter of fact, a lot of them should be going up for trial, and maybe that's what will happen. We're going to have to depend on the people across the nation to wake up and do some good work on their grand juries, federal and state, and within their own neighborhoods, and figure out what's going on and who needs to be brought in for this, because people need to answer for this. The newspaper should be what's keeping us free. And right now, they're working for the enemy and have been doing so for probably the last 50 years. More and more every year, as the years have gone by, today it seems like they're all on the payroll or something. I don't know what it is. But anyway, we got to get the word out.
Yeah, but I believe the principle that we were given in the founding of this country is the doctrine of the Declaration of Independence. I think it's what we formally need to do. And, you know, like I said, I believe martial law is at the door. So, I mean,
I think it's pertinent
that we move now in unity and file these charges as the originators did, and then we make a sovereign stand on that we are the people and we are the government.
Well, there's a few things that need to take place with this. This is what we're going to do. We're going to file these papers, and we're going to do it in a way that's going to blow people's minds. We've got a whole new way to put this together, and I think it's going to work very well. And people should really start rallying around this once we start moving this. But it's going to depend on the people. Look at our front page says, only the people can save America. There's no politician. There's nobody you can elect in office. There's no judge out there. Nobody's going to save him. Only the people can do it. Nobody else. But the question is the people going to do it? You know, look at while we're doing this work in the courts, which, again, you're going to start to see this in the next week or two or the next couple of weeks as we get ready these papers. We'll read them on a Monday night and we'll file them and we'll move them through the system. And we're going to another paper and another paper and another paper. We'll do as many as we can. And pull it all together, and it's all gonna spell out one thing: subversion against the United States of America by enemies both foreign and domestic. That's what it's gonna spell out, and it's gonna put the names of who these people are, and we got lots of names to go out after, and we got lots of evidence and lots of information to go out after, and that's what we'll do. We'll go through that process, but it's gonna take the people. That on itself is not enough. We need the force of the people behind this. If we have a hearing somewhere for whatever reason, we better overwhelm that building with people. We got to let them know that we, the people, are tired of this. We need the people to get up on their local level, the grassroots level, which is what has to be done. People need to run this country from the grassroots. No individual, no group can run the country. It's got to be grassroots. Every local, government is different one from another. They have different problems, different situations. You know, whatever it is, they need to take control of what's happening on the local government. All politics is local. And then, of course, if you understand the process from the local and how it works, because I was in the committeeman process, and I see the whole system, how this whole thing works, politically speaking, and how the body politics actually should be working, and I see how it is working. We're going to talk more about that in the very near future. But the bottom line on this body politic thing, look at every election district also sits within different other districts that control the state government, the county government, the state government, right up into the federal government. You know, they got representation from all these different governments from every single election district in America. And people need to understand that what power that is. And how you, the people, get to sit as a committee man and decide who's going to go on that ballot. Because if you don't know the Constitution, and if you don't say that you're going to be honorable and take an oath to do the right thing when you're in office, then we're not going to support you. We're not going to get you on the ticket. And we throw them out. Because right now, it's the exact opposite. They want people who don't know the Constitution. They want people who are criminals already, who will do the wrong thing and not the right thing. And those are the people we get stuck having to vote for over and over and over again. And I'll tell you, I'm sick and tired of it, to be honest with you. I'm just tired of it. But we have to take that control back. The people have to be doing that right now through operating through the committees of safety, which is the beginning. When we take our grassroots back from the committees of safety nationwide, then we're going to then move those committees of safety to take control of the committee man process. Because right now, there's no one at the helm except for the New World Order. We don't even know who these people are that control everything in these committee man processes right across America. They get to decide everything. They decide who's running for president and who's not. And it's it's a mess. But we have to fix it. We, the people, have to fix it. So people need to get into the committees of safety. Some people need to sign up to become administrators, which is a paid job. It's a career job. The administration for the grand juries. And people need to get involved in the committee man process and take control of their local community and push behind these court cases. All has to be done at the same time. And we got to accomplish this very soon. I'd say 3 to 6 months, we have to accomplish 3/4 of the nation or more in order to be successful. So we have no time to lose. We have to get going now. Anyway, we're going past our time. I want to take the last caller. There's one other person left. Thanks a lot. Who is that, Alan?
It's Alan, yes, sir. But okay. So we're not going to, I mean, we're going to watch Haman and the Bundys and stuff be persecuted. I mean, that's what.
No. We're in the middle of that. We're all in the middle of that. Look at, you know, a lot of things have slowed down a bit because I was ill, and I literally was just inoperable for 2, maybe 3 weeks, and just forget about it. Couldn't do nothing. I think it was, I don't even know what was wrong with me, to be honest with you. I think it was just exhaustion, because I do put, you know, 16, 20 hours a day into this. I just don't stop. But I've been, you know, that way for all my life anyway. I'm just always active in whatever it is I'm doing. But I guess it just caught up with me. And but now that I'm back and moving and we got a lot of things happening and a lot of ideas have come to play, and now we're going to move on things. And it's going to be, we're heading out to Oregon, so to speak. We're heading out also out there to Nevada, so to speak. We're going to become very involved. We're going after Judge Brown. That woman belongs in jail. That's where she belongs. And she has broken so many laws. She has violated so many unalienable rights of the people. She is so evil. It is so obvious that she just wants these people in jail, and she wants to participate in the taking away of this property to give it to China or to Russia or some other foreign entity, corporations. You know, I'm telling you right now, if things continue and we don't do anything about what's out west, the next thing we'll turn around, we're going to have, China is going to have a military base out there. And Russia, too, right on American soil in a prime land. It's what feeds us. It's the lumber industry, the mining industry, the cattle industry, all of that is out there. They've already destroyed our farmlands with big corporations. Totally destroyed them. And we gotta fix this problem. That's gonna be a hard one to fix, but it's gotta be fixed once we get control. Anyway, let me move to our last person. Thanks a lot, Alan. Tim, you got a minute or so because we're at the end.
Thank you, John, for taking my call. This is Tim from Michigan. I'll make it quick. Is the procedure of the people rising and removing their hat when the judge enters the court, is that proper?
Well, you know, we should be respectful to certain things. I don't know about rising, and I don't know about removing. Well, I guess removing a hat, if you leave your hat in a house, that I think is a little disrespectful maybe. But I don't know. What do you think about these things, Brent? I mean, we do want to be respectful, but, you know, we don't owe that person any real allegiance per se. Brent, are you still here? Do you have a comment on that? Maybe Brent is gone.
I had to unmute myself.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
I forget if I'm muted or unmuted. It's all
part
of
our... Yeah, if you got a short thought on that, I don't want to keep it too long because we're 7 minutes over. Actually, we're 12, 15 minutes over, almost 10 minutes.
Well, thanks for reminding me. You know, it's part of our common law tradition to be respectful. And the respect we pay in such a case, I don't know how the judge would take it, but the way I take it, my respect is to the court. And when I talk to a judge, I talk about the court this and the court that, and the respect we have is for the principle of the court. And so standing's not a bad thing. I like the idea of taking the hat off. I grew up that way, and I followed that. I still do it. I know most people don't now. It's popular to leave your hat all inside, but it is a respect to the court. It's respect to the office. It's respect to what we're doing here. There's nothing wrong with it. I do it. And I don't hesitate to do it, and I encourage other people to do it. And believe me, there are a lot of judges I don't think know squat from straight up, and if they do, maybe they're just downright crooked and got the wrong point of view. I still do it. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor the king, and do not speak evil of the magistrates of your people. That's in the Bible, and it does create order, and it's important to do even if you think they're all wrong. I think it's important. That's my follow-up, John.
Okay, thanks. All right, Tim, appreciate the question. If you want to ask some more, maybe next week you can catch up with us. Thanks a lot.
Yes,
we're going to end the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to end our program for the night. We appreciate everyone coming, and Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. We have a lot to talk about next Monday, and also hopefully Thursday or Tuesday, but I think it's going to be Thursday. We're going to be calling out for the grand jury to come to meet to discuss some things. You're going to want to be there. You take part of this thing, and we're going to be making some big moves in the courtroom. In the courts, in a different way than we've been doing it in the past. We're going to do it totally different and kind of unique at the same time. We have to save this nation. So let's get that done. Let's do what we got to do. Okay, see you then. Good night. I'd like to just make one final note that I did create the email address IDEAS, I-D-E-A-S, at nationallibertyalliance.org. So anybody with ideas, send us your information. Make sure you put your name and your phone number on it. We may want to call you, but we'll definitely have your email address anyway if you don't want to do that. But, okay, thanks a lot for everyone coming. Good night.